Peter acted sick.
Never mind that.
Why, that's me! Look at me! I'm an old man!
Hey, I'm Dr. Emmett Brown. I'm standing here on the parking lot at...
Thank God I still got my hair! What on earth is this thing I'm wearing?
Wow, this is a radiation suit.
Radiation suit? Of course. Because of all the fallout from the atomic wars. This is truly amazing. A portable television studio. No wonder your president has to be an actor. He's got to look good on television.
Whoa, this is it. This is the part coming up, Doc.
No. This sucker's electrical. But I need a nuclear reaction to generate the 1.21 gigawatts of electricity.
What did I just say?
The flux capacity stores... This sucker's electrical. But I need a nuclear reaction to generate the 1.21 gigawatts of electricity.
1.21 gigawatts! 1.21 gigawatts! Great Scott!
What the hell is a gigawatt?
How could I have been so careless? 1.21 gigawatts! Tom, how am I going to generate that kind of power? It can't be done, can it?
But all we need is a little plutonium.
Oh, I'm sure that in 1985, plutonium was available in every corner drugstore, but in 1955, it's a little hard to come by. Marty, I'm sorry, but I'm afraid you're stuck here.
Oh, Doc, stuck here? I can't be stuck here. I got a wife in 1985. I got a girl.
Is she pretty?
Oh, she's beautiful. She's crazy about me. Look at this. Look what you wrote here, Doc. I mean... That says it all. Doc, my only hope.
Marty, I'm sorry, but the only power source capable of generating 1.21 gigawatts of electricity is a bolt of lightning.
What did you say?
A bolt of lightning. Unfortunately, you never know when or where it's ever going to strike.
We do now.
This is it. This is the answer. It says here that a bolt of lightning is going to strike the clock tower precisely 10:04 p.m. next Saturday night. If we could somehow harness this lightning, channel it into the flux capacitor, this might work. Next Saturday night, we're sending you back to the future.
Operator, give me the number for 911.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
It's the end of time, and the Mississippi River, she's a going dry. The interest is up, and the stock market's down, and you're only getting mugged if you go downtown. back in the woods, you see. A woman and the kids and the dogs and me. I got a shotgun, a rifle, and a four-wheel drive, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I can plow a field all day long. I can catch catfish from dusk till dawn. Make our own whiskey and our own smoke too. Ain't too many things these old boys can't do. We grow good old tomatoes and homemade wine, and country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. Because you can't starve us out and you can't make us run. Those women born boys raised on shotguns. We say grace, we say ma'am. If you ain't into that, we don't give a damn. We came from the West Virginia coal mines and the Rocky Mountains and the western skies. We can skin a buck, we can run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. I had a good friend in New York City. He never called me by my name, just Hillbilly. My grandpa taught me how to live off the land, and his taught him to be a businessman. He used to send me pictures of the Broadway nights, and I'd send him some homemade wine. But he was killed by a man with a switchblade knife. For $43, my friend lost his life. I'd love to spit some beach nut in that dude's eyes and shoot him with my old 45, cause a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive. North California and South Alabama and little towns all around this land. We can skin a buck and run a trot line, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive.
here? What was that ruckus?
What ruckus?
I was just in my office and I heard a ruckus.
Could you describe the ruckus, sir?
Watch your tongue, young man. Watch it.
Everybody, you're listening to Shazizz Radio at www.shazizzradio.com. If you want to join in on the chat, this ought to be an interesting one here. Jump over there to a superchat.html over there at shazizzradio.com, and you get to see the Awake Radio chat room and the Shazizz Radio chat room at the same time. So anyway, I posted several links over there. Also, if you want to join in on the Skype call or something like that, add me as a user, or Thomas or Raymond as a friend contact on Skype. A user. Don't add me as a user. I'm not a user.
No, you got an L in front of that.
A loser. Oh, okay. Man, I'm throwing up the L sign on my forehead at you. Man, we need some live screen so you guys can see me like all animated and waving my hands in the air and stuff while I talk and stuff. Anyway, plus the loser sign, I just. Anyway, I threw some links in there. Today, trying to talk about a subject that I know Raymond really interested in, and a lot of people are into hydrogen technology and water cavitation and hydrogen. I just said hydrogen. Hydrogen, cavitation, water hammer, and something else. Doggone it. Anyway, through several video links inside there. I won't go down the list of all of them, but one of the ones that really got me started on this was a conversation that I had with Ryan last night. It was pretty cool. The guy's got some brilliance, man. I told him yesterday he's his worst critic because he actually reminded me. My friends keep me grounded because, you know, somebody messing around trolling him or other people out there trying to do research and show them cool things. And, you know, sometimes after a while you get to taking all that serious. Well, he put it in perspective for me, and I hope I did the same for him. And basically, we know knuckleheads are going to be knuckleheads no matter what you do, but I might have to sometime play that song, Nobody's Going to Break My Stride. That's a good song. Because I think what we got going on here is a bunch of brilliance from all over the place that if we can actually get some things accomplished that we're talking about, then I think the world will benefit. But he showed one video that he did where he actually using electricity to spin water. And so when I saw that video first, the very first thing that came to my mind was a hydraulic clutches inside of an automatic transmission and the way that they function. And also there's a couple video links inside there. There's a couple different designs out there for spinning water using electricity, because water is a dipole molecule. So if you got a magnetic field in the center of that thing, and you can induce a current on it or whatever, there's multiple ways that you can actually get that water to move around. And I was thinking also the video that he posted where he was using a coil to pulse a neodymium sphere inside a bowl. And I was thinking, man, what if he had water inside that bowl while he was spinning that magnet? You know, the centrifugal force of that magnet spinning around in there would start to produce a vortex inside there and get that water to spin it. And all he was using was a coil to actually spin that thing around just like a regular pulse motor would run. So I forgot to ask him about that yesterday. If you happen to be listening to this or the podcast, Ryan, get with me on that if you can. I'd like to see that same experiment done with some water inside there to actually see that when that neosphere is actually spinning around inside that bowl, that it could actually get that water to turn in. I think that that would be pretty cool. So, moving on down, there is a device. I can't remember the actual date that it was actually created, but it's back in the 1800s that used some pretty interesting anomalies of physics to actually do multiple things. Create a water hammer inside there. He's talking about how this thing would actually even create microwaves that would cause the water to heat up. And it's all part of basically what you got when you got water is you got one awesome fuel. I mean, just in the hydrogen section alone, if you can separate the water into its two elements, you know, hydrogen and oxygen, now you got two different gases that'll burn. One's got an implosive, you know, effect to it, and the other one is basically, I guess, oxygen would be an explosive, wouldn't it, Thomas? Yeah? No?
You're going to get an implosion, I guess, because if you're burning those two together, Water water condenses at a much lower temperature than two gases by themselves.
Yeah.
So the second you burn them, now they suddenly want to operate at a, in a much smaller space with the amount of energy you're imparting in them to keep them agitated and vibrating around.
Okay, and then either way, Raymond mentioned about how water will expand 1,600 times its mass whenever it's flashed into steam. So when I'm seeing all these devices, I'm seeing past just that one little anomaly. I'm seeing what happens if you add all these effects in together. The water cavitation, which is another video link we posted down there. One of them's a tiny URL that goes to some cavitation videos, because I couldn't get to the actual video that I wanted to pop up there. But the guy made a drum that has a bunch of holes in there, and he spun it up with like a 3/4 horsepower electric motor, and by spinning this water around, was able to generate a water hammer that was actually raising the temperature up there to where he was actually exceeding, as far as the BTUs, everything, the energy input that he was putting on the other side. And so, literally, he was getting the equivalence of over unity. You know, we could debate that whether or not it's actually over unity or not, but the fact of the matter is, without burning any kind of fuel or using any kind of radioactive rods, all he did was take some electricity, spin some water up at high RPMs, and produce heat and steam at the same time. That's pretty doggone impressive. Now imagine if you could combine not only the cavitation effect, but the hydrogen separation as well, and the hydraulic pressure that you could get from that water actually spinning. You see what I'm talking about here? Where you, if you've got a, you know,
I do.
You understand how an automatic transmission works. Whenever your engine is spinning that up, it spins that automatic transmission fluid inside there, it spins it up, and once that automatic transmission fluid gets up to speed, the hydraulic pressure behind it is enough to engage the clutches and circulate that fluid through the transmission in order to cool it back down.
Isn't automatic transmission a very simplistic Tesla turbine?
Well, yeah, that's another
that's
thing.
The way it works. It works almost exactly like the Tesla turbine.
Yeah, and that's another thing. It was also in that other video that, what was it, Keeley, or let me see if I can look at it. Doggone it. I already closed that window down. What was the name? Dale Pond explains John Keeley's water implosion device. He also talked about in there how they had a copy of the Tesla turbine there, and that they believe that part of the effect that was they were getting in this machine that was built in the 1800s was what was going on in the Tesla turbine. So yeah, you're correct, and that's in the automatic transmission. See, Tesla, he showed a lot of stuff, but all these anomalies, and people paid attention to them. They realized that they didn't have to just use these for wireless energy transfer. They could use the physics that they learned from some of the experiments, because I always try to explain electricity with water, right? Because if you can understand water and plumbing, how you got a large pipe and you can get a large flow of water, which would be the current, you know, high current, and then you drop that big pipe down into a little pipe, you you restrict the flow enough, cause the resistance where you can cause the pressure to rise, and so you get high pressure, which would be the equivalence of high voltage by changing the size of the pipe. You see what I mean? And so if you can understand plumbing, you can understand electronics, because that's exactly what's going on in there. That inside the electronics, you've got basically gate valves, check valves, a check valve or a gate valve, you know, one way. One, it'll only allow the pressure to go one way, like a diode, right? Will only allow the electricity to go one way. And so by taking a large windings on your primary, you allow a lot of current to flow through there, which creates a really strong magnetic field, and that magnetic flux goes through the core of a transformer and then back into a smaller wire, which would be the equivalent of a smaller pipe, and raises the pressure of that energy flow up. So you'll lower down the current, the amount of volume that you can push at one time, but you will spike up the voltage, just exactly like putting your finger over the garden hose effect. Well, knowing all these little anomalies and seeing all the things that Tesla worked on and how magnetic fields work, you know, like throwing the pebble in the pond and then keep that steady frequency going and watch those waves get bigger and bigger, and the effects of steam and water hammers, combining all these things together is what I've been trying to point out, is that...
Wait a minute. What about this back EMF and cavitation? Isn't that the exact same thing?
Well, yeah, I think so.
Cavitation of water is nothing more than back EMF of electricity.
Yeah. You can take any coil. It doesn't matter what it is. You don't even have to have a secondary on it. You can just use the primary alone. Or you could actually just use the secondary alone. And you can hook it to a battery. When you put that on the battery at first, you can have your thumbs on that thing and it won't shock you on the way out. But the moment you release one of those wires, if you're still touching both of those wires, that back EMF, when that field collapses, will shock the crud out of you. Alright, so that's pretty much
same thing with the water hose too, right?
Yeah.
Electricity and hydraulics work exactly the same, we just use different terms to describe it, so that someone will know that we're talking about hydraulic or electricity. That's all. Back EMF, cavitation of what?
And just like water will always find its level, so will electrical energy will always find its level. And that's why I keep telling people...
Amen. You're right.
That's why I keep telling people that a dead battery has just as much potential energy in it as a fully charged battery. It is just... balanced out. When that battery is completely flat, that means all the electrons are right back to where they were in nature. And how we actually get some sort of reaction out of that is because, number one, the terminals are far enough apart on the deal, and we put an electrolyte inside the battery so that when we charge this thing up, it causes the electrons to flow from one plate to the other more than they would the other. And so now that battery is literally off balance, and it can't balance itself out until you actually create a path, which is the equivalence of you putting a light bulb to that battery. Then those electrons can flow back to where they are, and according to how much resistance that is between there will determine how fast that energy goes. Like if you take a car battery and you take a steel wrench and you ram it down on those posts, you'll get a dead short that'll cause that battery, the energy in that battery can literally explode that battery. And that's why you don't want to do that. So the same thing with a capacitor. When you fully charge a capacitor up, the moment you take a screwdriver and touch across those terminals, that energy will instantaneously balance itself back out, and you can literally explode the capacitor by shorting it out. But if you've got a connection to that has just a little bit of resistance, then you can actually watch as that energy will slowly bleed back over and balance itself out. That's how we use batteries and capacitors. What do you guys think?
I think you got a good idea there. And what I was trying to say in other programs before today, what about Florida? I mean, what about electricity? What about lightning? I mean, everybody talks about, well, we need to store the light. No, you don't store it. You use it right now.
Yep.
I mean, the state of Florida alone in one 24-hour period has enough lightning stored, electricity released naturally, to light the entire city of New York for 10 years. Why can't we just... wait a minute, a capacitor, all right? So you were talking about the charges, but we charge it as a man. We do build a compressor and we build a machine that will create electricity or generate electricity. I'm sorry, no, I don't like the word create. I like generate. You generate electricity and you charge the capacitor. What you're doing is you're causing an imbalance.
Yeah, right? That's all you're doing.
Okay, so once it's in imbalance, then you can release it all at once and, like you said, blow the capacitor. Or you can release it slowly with a little resistance, and all of a sudden you've got usable electricity.
Yeah.
So, now wait a minute. The earth and the clouds contain water, and that's what this program is about, hydraulics, right?
Yeah.
And the similarity between hydraulic and electricity. You've got moisture in the air, and it's the wind's blowing it around. It's destabilizing. Now, all we have to do is don't let the lightning explode and blow up trees, houses, and kill people. Duh, we use it.
Yeah, you could actually control where that lightning lands, you know, right. Because lightning is going to take the shortest path to ground that it can find.
But my point is, don't let it reach that point.
Yep.
You put enough balloons with copper wire into the air, and the imbalance will trickle down that wire into the grid system where people can actually use it.
Yep.
Then you have a safety valve where if for some reason it builds too much, then you discharge it into the earth, which is no longer lightning. It's... I don't know what the heck I'm saying. I mean, it's electron flowing gently.
Well,
not busting a balloon.
Have you ever been walking through the woods with your brother, and your brother, he's in front of you, he pushes ahead and pushes a branch out of the way, and then that branch reaches back and slaps you with the vengeance?
Right.
Well, that's no different than what you're talking about as far as the way that energy, when it balances itself back out. Once that energy balances itself back out, that tree branch is perfectly safe. But when it's in motion, boy, it'll lay you out, man.
And the thing is, I learned because my older brother used to love to do that. We'd go out in the woods playing, and he'd be walking in front of me, and next thing you know, he'd be pushing on this limb, and I didn't get smacked with it two or three times. All of a sudden, I learned. Watch him. When he starts bending that limb, and I realize that he's going to let that sucker go. So I always carry a big stick with me. Walk softly, you carry a big stick. You know, I held the stick up vertical in front of me, and when that limb came back, it hit that stick, and I would brace it, and it would come back gently.
Well,
you got to use it.
That's it. That's controlling that power. And
don't let the clouds build so much energy that they cause a lightning bolt. You can do away with lightning by simply using it before it becomes a lightning bolt.
What's cool about this water hammer effect, especially with the spinning drum, is that you can actually control the temperature just by speeding up or slowing down that water. You know, you can control how fast that nature builds up that potential energy on the other side just by the energy input that you put on the other on the input side. And that's the same thing what I'm talking about with my plasma reactor and how I intend on using it, was that I can adjust the intensity of that plasma by the input that I put on the inside, which in turn will adjust the frequency that's coming out the opposite side. So it could be a fine-tuned heater, is the way I'm trying to explain this. And so with the water cavitation and the steam power, if you add all these things in together, if you can generate the water, spin that water fast enough to create the cavitation effect, which starts to heat that water and generate it into steam, then you can take that steam and you can do multiple things with it. You can run turbines with the doggone deal. You can heat water for your hot water heaters. You can circulate water through your entire house structure and use the older style radiator system in order to keep yourself warm in the winter time. And as long as that water is moving, it's not going to freeze up. And so, you know, with that said, throwing in the third one in there is that hydrogen technology, when you split the hydrogen and oxygen apart, And when it recombines, that releases a charge where now you can pull electricity off of it as well. And that was merely by spinning that water up, separating it, and having the hydrogen and oxygen separate, and not just with the steam, the heat of the steam, but just a small current applied to the two separate coils that it would require to make some sort of electrolysis. You see what I'm saying? Yeah? No? Hello?
Hello, I see exactly what you're saying.
Tom has got the cricket going on. Anyway, so adding all these anomalies in together is the key, man. Because we know that water will expand 1,600 times its mass, so there's a lot of pressure going on there. We know that water separated can have an implosive and basically burn, And so using some of the things that we've learned from different experiments, like Ryan did with the pulse motor, where he's actually spinning a magnet around inside a bowl, that's one way you could actually get that cavitation effect going on. Without having to have a huge electric motor to turn it, you get the water to turn it and use that hydraulic pressure, which equals out to torque. You get water spinning around in a circle, and it has a lot of torque to it. You know what I mean? So
exactly, a lot of torque.
Yeah.
I mean, you just mentioned it earlier about the automatic transmission. It's fluid. I mean, what's the difference between water and oil? Because they're both fluids.
I think they call it hydrodynamics.
Exactly, dynaflow.
Yeah. So, if you got this hydraulic pressure going on. There's in actual hydraulics itself, it has a pump inside the hydraulic system that basically is a positive displacement pump, which means that it will only allow fluid to go one direction. It won't. It's like gears put together, and there's no way for the fluid to go back the other direction. And so when you're forcing this under pressure inside a tube that has another tube, a rod inside that with a plunger on it, it causes hydraulic pressure to literally be able to lift multitudes times its own weight. And that's how you're able to get these tractors with buckets on there and bobcats and bulldozers to be able to raise heavy objects and stuff like that using hydraulics. But there ain't no reason why you couldn't use that same anomaly. Because this hydraulic pressure can be released instantaneously. If you've ever used a floor jack, then you'll understand what I'm talking about. Simply by turning that screw backwards, you'll drop your car right on the doggone ground, just like that. Nature will balance itself out, and hopefully your foot isn't under the tire. So, we talked about all these different deals right here, and now if you threw in your two-stage oscillator in there and you was able to create enough hydraulic pressure spinning water fast enough, not only would you be generating heat, but you could also use that for a hydraulic pump to literally raise a hydraulic cylinder up to tap your two-stage oscillator with as much energy that it would take for you to do it manually. You see what I'm saying?
Exactly.
So this is the way my brain thinks. I don't just look at it as a simple anomaly. Where that's what a lot of the problems with a lot of the trolls out there. They got simple minds and just can't understand what it is that you're trying to show them. When Ryan does experiments where he's actually lighting multitudes of LEDs off of a small amount of voltage in a battery using things like they call it the jewel thief circuit. Where you can drain out a lot of energy out of a battery that wouldn't even run the flashlight anymore. And so he's learned enough about the way that the physics of the science actually functions that using these different circuits. And last night I was talking to him about, I call it like a domino circuit, where if you had a TIP 42C transistor that was running what they call the Slayer exciter circuit. I think that was initially designed by G. Bleuer or somebody. Anyway, but that one circuit, it has a field that goes out so far, and you can extend the field by adding a couple things like a top load to it or an earth ground, whatever, is what Ryan was explaining to me. You can get more range out of it, but even at that, you still got a certain amount of range that you can get out of that. And so what I was talking about was using capacitors, the same voltage but different sizes, to actually act as tank circuits and timers. So you could get the largest capacitor would take longer to fill up down to the smallest one with a shorter time filling up. So these would actually be able to be timed out for when the capacitor got filled up, it would fire a TIP 42C transistor or whichever one you decided to use. And then once that discharge happened and that transistor fired, then it would fire the next one in line and then the next one in line all the way up to the larger size capacitor. And what this would do is when that wave goes out, before that wave even makes it all the way out to its maximum, there's already another wave coming in behind it that is bumping that wave out yet even further. You see what I'm saying? And so just like dominoes, it keeps slapping the wave out further and before it has the opportunity to collapse. And then in the process, once you got your field way out there, now you know that that field is actually going to come back. Right? And so when it does, when the field finally does collapse in on itself, if you had multiple layers of the secondary on there, you know how far out that field goes. You could literally build a multi-layer coil system as wide as that field, and then not only would you get the energy on the way out, but you would get the energy on the collapse back in as well. You see what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do, but I've got a question. What if you can't use it, and all of a sudden you're generating more electricity than you need, then you need a safety valve to release it?
Yeah.
Like, for example, when a lightning bolt strikes the earth, it strikes a tree or whatever, and it explodes, you don't want that. You need a safety device to where when you've got all these balloons sticking up in the air with all this copper wire to it, and you're collecting all this electricity and putting it into the grid. Now, all of a sudden, the night fall, and you don't need all this electricity, but what are you going to do, pull the balloons down? No, release the electricity into the earth.
That's right. You take and build you up.
Bolt,
you take
to balance things out because it's genuinely creating, and I hate that word.
You take and make you
electricity constantly, and we're not using it. So the thing is, everybody wants to store it. So why store it? It's being made every second of the day and night.
You take and make you a safety spark gap that is specifically there designed for if the voltage gets above a certain range that it will leap across that spark gap and ground it right straight to the earth.
Exactly, my point.
And so, all of these deals right here are plausible. I mean, it's science. When you pulse a wave out, that wave is going to collapse. You know, it's nature's going to balance it back out, and that's where the back EMF comes in. So imagine if you designed a Tesla coil that had multiple layers, and you could on this Slayer exciter that Ryan put together for me with the coil and everything, I tried building one myself, and the first time I tried it, it didn't work, and I couldn't figure out what the heck was going on. Turns out I had the coil backwards, you know, because you got to have the primary and the secondary going in the same, you know, direction as far as the turns wise. Well, I had one of the two backwards, and all I had to do was simply flip that thing around, and it fired right up and it worked. Well, so imagine if you had a multi-layer secondary that even actually had capacitor layers in between every other deal, that when each one of the the first primary is going one direction, the second primary is going the opposite direction. The one going the opposite direction is for when the energy collapses in on itself. And then as that energy is collapsing in on itself, you use that energy to charge that capacitor layer, which you in turn have a spark gap that fires right back into the initial primary and gives you an extra pulse. You see what I'm saying?
100%.
So, with that said, we got the knowledge right now to build some really bad to the bone coil systems, man. And you don't even have to stop there. I mean, the modern day microwaves, the way that they're designed, me and Ryan was talking yesterday, and he was pointing out that he thinks that that's the way that the modern-day flyback transformers are working. And so, it's not like it's a new idea, but it's an idea that should be, you know, kept out there on the table, because if you could design a coil like that and maximize the usage of not just the field going out, but the collapse as well, because you know exactly where that field is collapsing back to, because you got the initial primary that sent the field out, right? So, yeah, it's going to collapse in on itself. And on the way back, all we're doing when we're passing magnets back and forth across the coil of wire is changing from north to south, right?
Right.
So, when it's going out, maybe it's north, and when it's coming back, maybe it's south. So now you get those lines of flux going through there, and you throw a core inside the center of that doggone thing, and now you got yourself a transformer. So you could build a transformer that I seriously believe could literally be at least halfway self-oscillating. You know, I know that sounds like, what's the word I'm looking for, contradicting itself. But I'm not saying that you're not going to have to put an input into it. I'm saying that when you send the energy out, you know that the energy is going to collapse back in on itself if you're pulsing this, right?
Exactly.
So why not utilize that and build a transformer that's going to be super efficient? And it would take a lot. And you know that whenever you sit there like your two-stage oscillator, you actually have to put a little effort to start the first time. But from that point on, once you got that, they call it the boy on the swing effect going, and it gets easier as you go to keep that going.
It's like, easier.
And it's like that redneck hot tub that I made. You know, normally it takes about 4 to 6 hours to get it up to operating temperature. But once you get it up to operating temperature, it doesn't take nothing to maintain that temperature. All you're doing is keeping a constant flow of energy going to it. It's not under a load. It's just whatever it took to heat it up to begin with is what it takes to keep it maintained. And it's not that difficult to understand. Same thing with a pilot light in your.
So, to emphasize what you just said, the American Railroad System about 10-15 years ago took out a full page ad in an industrial magazine bragging about how they could move 40 tons of product 40 miles on 1 gallon of diesel fuel. They turned right around about 4 or 5 years ago and took out the same ad again in the same industrial magazine bragging how they had improved it and they could now move 60 tons. That's 120,000 pounds of product 40 miles on 1 gallon of diesel fuel. Now, what you just said, it takes a lot of energy to get it up and get moving. But once it's moving, it takes very, very little energy to maintain that motion.
Yep.
And that's why a railroad train can move so much, because it takes so much energy to get it up to speed. But once they get it to that speed, they simply maintain it. And there's no friction. You have steel wheels against steel track. No friction. You have one car directly behind the other. The only thing that has true friction is the locomotive engine itself busting the air out of the way, and the side friction of the cars. If they made the sides of the cars super, super slick, and join them together somehow with plastic or whatever to where the air couldn't go in between the cars, they could probably move 100 tons of product 40 miles on a gallon of diesel fuel.
Yeah, just like they do the monorail.
Moving. It is almost no effort to keep it moving, and what I'm going to say is going to sound ridiculous until you think about it. If I tell you that a rooster can pull a freight train, don't ask any questions. Just hook his butt up to it.
Yeah, if you kept the constant tension on that, eventually he's going to overcome that tension, and it'll get easier and easier for him to actually be able to keep it motion.
I tell you what, you can take a 10,000-pound boat, put it in the water, you can stand on the dock, and apply 20 pounds of force to that boat, and it's not going to move at first, but eventually it will.
Yep.
Once it starts moving, and you walk down the dock, maintaining the same 20 pounds of pressure, and the boat will actually gain speed until it gets to a point that the friction is equal to the 20 pounds, and at that point, that's as fast as you're going to go.
Yep.
Unless you apply more pressure. Now, once you get that boat going that fast, apply the same pressure, and it will maintain the same speed constantly.
So imagine this deal that we were talking about, like if you could actually spin water up and get that hydraulic pressure going. Now, the energy input maybe take you a little bit to get it started, but once you've got that started, you can decrease the energy input and just maintain that speed. It's kind of like the little kids on the merry-go-round, you know. When you first start off, it's hard to get going, but then after a while, all you got to do is reach out and tap it every so often, and you can keep that thing going at a constant speed. You see what I mean?
Yep. I tell you what, a simple, very simple experiment that people can try is take your blender, okay, and take a watt meter, plug it in the wall, plug your blender into the watt meter. Now, you take and fill the blender about half to two-thirds full of ice cubes, then put in a pint to a pint and a half of water. Now, turn that blender on. Put the lid on first, please. You're going to get a mess if you don't. Anyway, turn the blender on and watch your watt meter. You're going to read an unreal amount of watts at first, but slowly the watts are going to come down as the water starts to turn. Now, as the water turns, once it gets up to speed, the only friction you're going to have is when the blades of the blender hit the ice cube and break on apart. That is friction.
Yeah.
And before you know it, I mean, really quick, the ice is going to almost completely melt. Why is it melting? Heat. Friction.
Yep.
Now, once the ice melts and there is no more ice, there is no more friction other than the blades keeping the water turning and churning and churning. And you'll watch your watt meter will come way, way down, but yet the temperature of your water will start to rise. Uh-oh. What's going on here? Phenomena? No. It's pure unadulterated physics.
Yep.
Friction.
And since energy is always going to take the path of least resistance, that's why it's a good idea to put the top on the doggone blender before you turn it off.
You dang on straight, because you will get a mess.
Anyway, I think that we could actually take all these doggone anomalies that we're talking about, water hammers, water cavitation, hydrogen technology, hydraulic pressure, and literally build a generator based off of water alone. You know, water's pretty impressive when you get down to the brass tacks of the whole deal. You can do a lot.
I like what you said earlier about water being dipolar. Di meaning two. It has a positive and a negative pole. And people make Jocells, which is a Jocell is nothing more than two pieces of stainless steel, and you hook direct electricity to it, direct current. And by doing so, you're creating a magnetic field. You're literally pulling the hydrogen atoms one way and the oxygen atoms the other way. Now, I've done this, and what I'm getting ready to tell you, if you put a magnet on one of the plates and a magnet on the other plate, if you get the polarity correct, you will generate anywhere from 50 to 100% more hydrogen and oxygen with the same amount of electricity.
I wish there was a way that you could physically see when you bring a magnet in proximity of a water molecule, if these water molecules are literally aligning themselves. You know how, like, if you put two magnets together, they'll flip over and basically connect to each other? You see what I'm talking about?
I see exactly, and that's exactly what I was talking about. Exactly.
Yeah, I wish there was a way that you could physically see this reaction, because then it's kind of like putting magnet paper over the top of a magnet. You can actually see the lines of flux on there. But to be able to see the water molecules doing what they're doing, then you'd be better to understand where to place these magnets. Like I was talking to Ryan last night about what if you took a magnet at the top and then one at the bottom on an opposite pole? And you could literally get a layered effect to where you got the bottom layer of the water spinning one direction where you got the top layer spinning the opposite direction. Well, you know what happens when you spin things in two opposite directions. You'll create a vortex in the center of that thing. You see what I'm saying?
Add a lot of heat because you're going to get a lot of friction.
Because the water will start fighting against itself and you'll build up friction inside that water. Now imagine if you could do this on a large scale like the size of a swimming pool. Not only would you have a massive amount of hydraulic pressure going on, but you'd have one heck of a heater as well. You know, on a smaller scale, if you actually think about it, what's going on out there in the farmers' fields where they have like cattle and stuff, they put these little turbines out there in the middle of the pond, and when the wind's blowing, it keeps that water agitated. And by keeping that water agitated, it won't freeze up. And the cows can still get water during the winter time because it's not frozen.
Pure simplicity.
Yeah. And so that same effect could be used to understand how the cavitation effect works. When you spin water around, those water molecules are attempting to align themselves every time you move them. Every time you slop the water, you cause an effect inside there because those water molecules are trying to align themselves back to where they were to start with, because it's got a negative and a positive side on there. So I would say that if you could, like, draw a bunch of circles on a piece of paper, plus, minus, that's what it would look like. The water molecules would align themselves, plus, minus. And any ones that were in the opposite, or, you know, opposites attract and positives repel. That's the effect that you'd get. And knowing that's how the water would align itself, then if you could throw that off balance by using the magnetic field to cause it to try to align itself, and every time the north come by, it tried to align itself to that, but it couldn't because it didn't have enough time because the magnet was spinning by, then that they would continuously be trying to align themselves, continuously be agitated. That's why I want to see that one experiment where Ryan's spinning the neosphere inside of a bowl without no water. I would like to see that same experiment with water, to not only be able to measure the temperature of the water as the magnet's trying to realign itself, when the water's trying to realign itself, and you see what I'm saying, to actually create the cavitation.
I see exactly what you're saying. I mean, exactly.
And he didn't have to put a whole lot of energy to be able to pulse that magnet to get it to go around, you know. And if you could do that with 12 volts and you could actually get these magnets to sit there and race around a circle, and you had two different layers of water spinning in opposite directions, it wouldn't take that much energy to cause it to happen. But once
you know, wait a minute, so the listeners don't think you're crazy, you and I both agree that it takes a lot of energy to get it up to snuff. But once it's there, it takes very little energy to maintain. So if Brian put this sphere in a bowl and put water in there, it's going to take a lot of energy to get that thing to go around until he gets that water moving. But the faster he gets the water moving, the less energy it's going to take until he gets to a certain point. This is going to take almost no energy to maintain that motion, but that motion is going to create friction, and the water is going to get hot. It's going to take a lot of energy to get it moving. But once it's moving, it takes very little energy to maintain. That's the whole secret.
Well, the strongest force...
The train doesn't have to stop for a red light, okay?
Yeah.
The train, once it's in motion, then the barricades come down and the cars have to stop. That's why the train can move so much product, so far, on so little energy. Because once it's up moving, it does not have to stop till it reaches its destination.
The strongest force in nature has been known to shove 2x4s through trees and bamboos through trees. And we call that a cyclone or a tornado or a hurricane, you know. But all of these different names on there, one basically, I guess you could say they're differentiated by the size. You know, like a tornado would be obviously smaller than a hurricane. But either way, you got hot air going one direction, and you got cold air coming in the other direction, and that cold air and the hot air mix creates a vortex that causes the spinning, and once that spinning gets up, it's got enough power to throw 2x4 through a tree, man. And how do you do that? You couldn't go up there and take a hammer and pound a 2x4 through a tree unless you wanted to sit there for a million years or so, but I'm thinking the 2x4 is going to give away before, you know, that tree does. But if you got enough doggone power, you can throw anything through anything. You see what I mean? And so, if you think about the vortex like a whirlpool, you could actually test this theory out. If you had a way that you could spin one container that was funneled down into another container, and you got the whirlpool going on one side, it'd be the equivalence of like a black hole, you know, where it's got a wide outer circumference all the way down into the center of that thing, which would squeeze everything into nothingness. But when it comes out the other side, that energy is going to disperse itself out in a wider pattern the farther it gets out. You see what I'm saying? So you'd have a tornado vertical, and then you'd have one upside down at the bottom container. Kind of like how it looks like when an hourglass is dropping sand down through there. You see what I'm saying?
Yep.
So maybe it's the case that you could actually make one that has a vortex on the top, like basically a tornado in a jar on the top, which creates a tornado in a jar on the bottom going in the opposite direction, and use the hydraulic pressure from both of them to, you know, capture your power off of, your energy. What do you think?
I like it.
You know, it's only, you're only limited by your imagination how far you want to take this. As long as you follow what they classify the laws or the rules of physics or whatever, and you already know what it's going to be doing. We know why Lenz's law happens. Why would we want to invoke it if it's going to be a drain on the system? So if we know that also, under the conservation of energy, you can actually change that energy to a completely different form, why not do that instead of actually trying to drain it directly off the generator head? Now, if you got a hydraulic pressure that is actually turning that generator head, and or creating the steam that's used to turn turbines was turning that generator head, and then on the opposite end, you're not using that in the conventional sense of how you actually use electricity, you know, draining it directly off that generator head. Could you imagine how super efficient that generator would be by pulling that energy off, changing it just long enough to keep it from going back into that generator head, moving it off into a completely different system, and letting that system there be the load where you pull the load from? What do you think? It's like filling up a swimming pool.
I like it.
Once you get that swimming pool filled up, you can poke a hole in the side of it. That water will shoot as far as the size of the diameter of that hole. How much pressure you want to relieve from it will determine on how fast it discharges. So, There you go, man. Now you not only know how to get the energy to do what you want it to do, but you also know how to control it on the other end, which is the equivalence of putting a diode on a capacitor. A screwdriver is a dead short. All that energy is going to instantaneously balance itself out with the potential to blow that capacitor in half because you just shorted it out, and that energy is trying to get out of there as fast as it possibly can. And so it, wow, it forces itself through the side, whatever. But if you slowly bleeding that thing off, you can run that doggone LED for quite some time off of that capacitor. Heck, they do it all the time. Those shake-up flashlights, they got a little rechargeable button cell battery and a capacitor in there. And basically, the capacitor does most of the work. So all you're doing is charging that capacitor up, which bleeds off into that button cell and runs the light bulb. What do you think?
I like it, and that's exactly what I was trying to get at about the balloons in Florida and fasten the copper wire. If you use the electricity that's being generated in the atmosphere, then there will be no lightning bolts. But if you all of a sudden the air is generating more electricity than you're using, then you need to get rid of it before it actually turns into a lightning bolt and burns your wire up or blows your balloons up.
Yeah.
Now, wait a minute. You've got a battery. Now, you want to charge it up, and you got the generator or something that is generating electricity, and you're pumping this electricity into that battery. Now, all of a sudden, if you don't put a charge controller on it, the battery will overcharge and explode. Correct?
Yep.
Okay. Now, all of a sudden, you put a charge controller on it, but the air, the atmosphere, is still generating electricity. So now, all of a sudden, you get a lightning bolt. No, you've got the... use not only a charge controller so that you don't overcharge your battery, but you've got to, once the battery is charged, the charge controller sends the electricity to another place, the ground. Therefore, you still don't get a lightning bolt.
That's right.
And the battery could be the grid system.
The atmospheric group took a couple 200-foot poles, put them up in the air, run a nanocarbon wire. They had the nanocarbon on the actual out of skin of the wire, and had them way up in the air, and they were bringing down 2,000 volts down into a bunch of capacitor banks. But their safety would be essentially what you just explained, and a safety gap that if the power up there in the atmosphere, because that's how lightning functions. When the air between the atmosphere and the ground becomes ionized high enough that it can actually make a path to ground, you're going to get a lightning bolt. So if you're draining off that energy before it ever even gets to that potential to jump from that gap, it's going to take the shortest path to ground. And so you're not going to create a lightning bolt, but you'll be pulling the energy that you want. See,
that is exactly what I've been trying to say.
Yeah, in all actuality, lightning rods aren't there to capture lightning. They're there to drain that energy off before it gets to that point.
100%, again, exactly what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. So by pulling the energy out, you reduce the chance that the air can become ionized enough for the lightning to hit the side of your house. That's what a lightning rod's for.
All right, so you put a lightning rod on your house, right, and you hook it to a battery. It charges the battery, not the ground. But if the battery gets completely charged, then you have a switch that makes it go the other direction to the ground.
Yeah.
Now, if you have enough lightning rods, then you have no lightning, but you have all that electricity.
You know, Raymond, that is absolutely brilliant, because as much as I'm sitting there thinking about the lightning rods, the reason why a lightning rod ain't able to pick up energy, because there is an equation that tells you how many volts that you get for every foot you get off the ground. I never even thought about that. You could literally disconnect the ground from that lightning rod and pull energy out until that battery got charged up, which in turn would hit a relay that would shift it right back over to the ground so that it could never overcharge itself.
Exactly. 117% correct.
Well, that's brilliant, man. So there's another good experiment, man. Like the radio, the CB antennas, the people's got these really tall tower CB antennas, but they're always grounded to the dirt, and there's a reason why, you know? Because you don't want lightning zapping your doggone antenna and frying out your CB radio. But I know hundreds, if not more, people that own CB radios with towers on there, and they're not blowing their stuff up even when it's lightning and outside. And unless there's a, you know, a higher potential in the air, and it just bypasses that antenna altogether, or maybe strikes maybe even a quarter mile away and some of that energy is dispersed into that antenna, you ain't got a problem. You see what I mean? Because it's already grounded.
Exactly. Without the ground, you take a 200-250 foot antenna tower, and if you don't ground it, you walk up 15 feet away, you're going to get your dink put in your watch pocket.
That's right. You become the spark gap.
Exactly.
Shortest path to ground. See, now that we understand all this kind of stuff, there's so many doggone experiments that could be done that would literally pull energy right out of the air. And I would think that in a populated area, this would be something that people would want to do because it would be a safety issue, you know. The same reason why they put doggone lightning rods up on 2- and 3-story buildings or higher, you know. Because the higher you get up there, the more likely it is for you to be the one that gets zapped, because it's going to take the shortest path to ground that it can. If the top of your roof is the shortest path to ground, then guess whose roof is getting it? You see what I mean?
Yep, I do.
So, I think that I've been saying this all along. If you can't find free energy, you're simply not looking hard enough for it, you know?
You know, the thing is, I don't know that much about electronics and that. And you said something a minute ago about what was the word you used? Relay.
Yeah.
Right. Once your battery's charged, you don't just stop the electricity going into the battery, because you literally in the atmosphere you have an totally unlimited supply of electricity being generated constantly. Now, if you don't use it, then you're going to get a lightning bolt.
Yeah.
So if you don't want the lightning bolt and your battery's full, then put a relay on it and transfer the energy to the ground.
Yeah.
Therefore, you don't get a lightning bolt. And my point is, you don't use a battery. You use the grid.
And you want to know the kicker about that whole deal?
Yeah.
I did a video here a while back where I showed I could light up a fluorescent light bulb using a tattoo gun. A tattoo gun isn't nothing more than a relay, all right? And what I was doing was capturing the back EMF when that relay goes out and locks in. And as soon as the relay turns off, there's going to be back EMF come up off of there. And so you can also capture the energy off of that doggone relay as it resets itself back to the open position where it's charging your battery again.
That is super cool, Shazam. I mean, dang God.
Yeah, try it sometime. Just get you a doggone relay and hook a 9-volt battery to it, click that thing on, and then release it and see. Keep your thumbs on the wire and see if you don't get the crud shocked out of you. It'll lay you out, man. Why do you think they talk about whenever you're messing around with coils off of cars that you need to be really careful? Because those coils will light you up. Especially the old Model T or Model A coils. Have you ever messed around with those?
Oh, yeah. It was fun, too.
Yep.
I might need to put my watch pocket several times.
Yep. Well, there you go, man. So, if we take and use the steam power for the pressure that we need, and the hydraulic power to actually raise water up to the steam power, there ain't no reason why you couldn't build a boiler system that would have some serious PSI to it. You know, an air compressor, if you take an air compressor, just the pump alone by itself, it's going to take a long time for that doggone tire to fill up. All right? But normally how you use an air compressor so that you're not putting the actual compressor itself under, you know, too much stress, is you got a reserve tank. And so you'll turn that air compressor on and let that tank build up to pressure, to the maximum pressure of what that actual compressor head itself can push out. And then you are actually airing your tire up with the reserve on that tank, and it's not putting the load on the actual compressor head. You see what I'm saying? So that's exactly what we've been explaining as far as electricity, water storage, or steam pressure. It's all the same concept. And that video that I did called Unsubscribe, where, you know, people were getting on my doggone nerves, and I'm sitting here through the entire video. When I first started turning that little hand crank generator, it had a little bit of pressure to it because it was just getting the system started. But once I got the energy flowing, that thing got easier and easier to turn. And while I'm sitting here talking to them, I'm loading up these capacitor banks that long after I stopped turning that doggone generator still was running. And all I had to do from that point on is I showed in the video, I walk over there and I flip the switch on the little AC charger and, you know, bring it up to about 9.2 volts and then turn the doggone thing back off again. And it's still running. And then long after I'm not putting any more power back into it, that thing will bleed itself down to the smallest circuit, and then the last thing to be going to will be a little piezoelectric beeper with a little blinking LED. But as long as that main capacitor bank stays full, all the rest of the loads underneath there will stay constant. And so if you designed a system doing everything that we're talking about right here, you could literally start off for an electric motor to spin water around. And of course, you're going to have batteries to charge that electric motor to spin the batteries around. But you get that RPMs up to get that water hammer going and the cavitation effect and get that water to spinning, then you follow the system all the way down to the steam, which is actually pressurizing in a container that is turning the turbine on the opposite side, the Tesla turbine, or however you want to design it, and then you use that power on the other side for to generate your electricity. Then you take that electricity you just generated, change the form long enough not to bog down that generator head, and then turn that energy back into usable current again on the other side where something else is carrying the load besides the generator head itself. In my mind, it's brilliant and it's simple. So, what do you guys think?
I think you just explained in really understandable language what you've been trying to talk about for over 2 years.
Yep.
It's exactly what you've been trying to talk about, but you explained it in a way that even a novice could understand, because I am a novice and I understand exactly what you're saying.
Well, you know, Thomas has a lot of knowledge in chemistry and stuff and how different materials will work with each other. And so guys like Thomas could actually pick out the best materials for us to make certain parts of this deal. And with his knowledge in 3D printing and running a CNC mill, there's another skill set, you know. By himself, he could do a heck of a lot. I mean, he could do an impressive amount. But imagine what he could do in the right lab with the right other people, the guys that are saying stuff like I say, you know, this is how I'm explaining the mechanics of what I'm seeing going on in this deal. Could you make this part right here? And yeah, I could make it, and we could make it best out of this particular material because it would reduce either friction or absorb heat or transfer heat or electricity, the most efficient way. And with your two-stage oscillator and mechanical skills and knowledge of leverage and stuff like that, throw that in the mix, and now you can say, well, yeah, and I think that if you make this one here just a little bit longer than what you had originally planned, you'll get a little bit more leverage, which will reduce how much force that you have to actually input in order to get this relay to kick up or down or whatever. You see what I mean? Now,
yes, I do.
You throw guys like Ryan Abrams and Deeds and Terry Woodruff and some of the other guys, Tesla Explorer, all these different guys out there into the mix, and now you got what I classify the dream team. Then there ain't nothing that we couldn't build. You get the equipment together, everything from metal lathes and a lot of the materials we could actually recycle or build ourselves using, you know, recycled stuff. So, with that said, I would be interested if we could pull together all these guys for a meeting just long enough to see, just to troubleshoot everybody's brains and see who would be interested in going how far and actually getting together and building a device. And when I say device, I mean the most energy efficient. And we don't even have to shoot for over unity or 0 point or anything like that, or even call it free electricity for that matter. Just to try to find the most efficient way to do like what you were doing with the gasoline engine. For the input, the most efficient way to deliver the fuel, the most efficient way to utilize the energy coming out the other side, the most efficient way to recapture any wasted energy or heat coming off of it, anything, and then ways to actually take the energy that we're getting off of there and move it away from the system so as not to put a load onto the deal. And then the final stage is the storage and basically turning that energy back into usable current, which you could drive either DC to AC inverters or whatever. And so, with that said, I would love to try to put together either a live stream or even a private Skype conversation with all these individuals at the same time and see who would be willing or able to go, you know, how far to where we could actually even contemplate on building, like Thomas has been talking about forever, is trying to find a centralized place to where we could actually build a shop, you know, that anybody at any time could go there. We can live stream the doggone thing 24/7 so people can see what's going on inside there and use that to maybe help to fund the program or whatever, you know. And then, you know, anybody who wanted to do any research could actually Skype in and be able to ask questions. You know, I see you guys working on this project over here, and I'm working on it over here, but we're kind of stuck at this point. And we could sit there and show them real time, look, yeah, this is what we used over here, and this is the material and where we got it, kind of thing. What do you guys think about that idea?
I love it. I really do.
I mean, if we could actually get this the ball rolling, that's what needs to be done. Because, you know, by ourselves, it gets kind of frustrating when you're trying to get things done, but I know that there's enough talent and enough resources and brain power out there that if we really seriously wanted to do it, we wouldn't have to have multi-millions of dollars to get things accomplished. And whatever funds that we did need to maintain, such as an internet connection or something like that, you know, we can throw up GoFundMe counts or something like that for people that wanted to help support it or whatever like that. See, I wouldn't be opposed to that if there were enough people involved in this situation that we're all going for the same goal, that we can show and prove what we're talking about all this time and make things that can actually prove these. I hate to call them theories because they're not theories, because they're proven science all the way back from the 1800s and prior all the way up to modern day. There are devices and technology out there that show that these concepts work. Now, what we haven't seen in all this time is all these concepts working in conjunction with one another. Hydrogen technology mixed with cavitation and hydraulic pressure and static electricity, you know, because when you turn the water through there, depending on what material you're spinning that water to there, it could actually build up a charge just like a Van de Graaff or a Wimshurst generator or a Lord Kelvin generator. You see what I mean? Recondensing the water, steam back into water at some point and allowing that water to fall down through steel pipes that would cross over each other and create a opposite charge that would then in turn zap across to a spark gap that would charge up capacitor banks. Dude, it's unlimited. With all these things together combined, it's unlimited what we could actually, it's only limited by our imagination, and we could make a super efficient system that you could then in turn present to the public and say, look, this is what we've done. It's maybe not necessarily over unity, but it is the most efficient way to use energy in the most clean, environmentally friendly manner. That if we was to use this in your state and our state, we can literally transfer our natural energy your way because, you know, we got a lot of wind over here, and you could send us some static electricity from your direction, and we just kind of crisscross the grid. We could actually literally tap into the grid that's already in existence and transfer energy from one point to the next. And we know that static electricity, any kind of energy out there, can be changed, the form of it, and we can change it before it ever even hits that grid, and we can light that grid up 24/7, even in the worst case scenario, man. You see what I mean? You're only limited by how far you're willing to take it. Now, we got the knowledge. If anybody out there is interested in wanting to try to do something like this, I'm not the kind of person who can actually get people organized. You know, it's like I can't, you know, herd chickens. Not calling everybody chickens, but if you ever saw Shaziz out there trying to get the chickens back in the coop, you'd laugh your booty off until you probably passed out or threw up or something, because I couldn't get them all to like run the same direction. So need somebody out there with the skill set of being able to talk to people and organize a time and a place where everybody can get together on live stream or Skype or whatever, and make this thing happen. You know, put the dream team together. That's how you're going to get what it is that you guys have been wanting to try to do forever and a day. You know, and you do justice to guys like Tesla and Stan Myers and John Bedini and all the guys out there that's been doing this for years, because you learned everything that they had to show you, and you took all those anomalies and you showed all these different devices out there and created stuff, and you showed how far you'd advanced in there. If you see some of the work that Deeds did, you'd be impressed at his meticulousness, and the guy's just, he's a really nice guy to talk to. Ryan Abrams is not only artistic, but he's brilliant. I love talking to that man, because the way that he thinks is just, it's amazing. Terry Woodruff, another nice guy out there, brilliant individual. You know, you add all these guys into the same group, and we go for a set goal that we're all we're going to do is try to build the most efficient generator that humanity's ever seen, the most clean running, environmentally friendly machinery. You know, you don't have to make radioactive rods to boil water. They were doing it with coal, and if you're worried about the pollution that comes off of burning coal, then recapture that crud, reburn the crud, just like they do with a catalytic converter in your car. You see what I mean?
But the catalytic converter is a waste, pure waste of energy. All it does is burn the fuel that your engine doesn't burn, because you're dumb enough to put liquid gasoline in your engine.
Sure, but
liquid
that's...
gasoline will not burn.
Sure, but that's the purpose...
not enough to burn.
That's the purpose that they put the catalytic converter in there, was to clean the emissions. What most of the energy that you're burning is getting wasted.
Exactly. Yeah. Don't burn gasoline, because number one, it will not burn. Gasoline fumes are highly explosive, but gasoline, the liquid, will not burn.
Well, I'm saying that if we want to do this, we already know we got it. The knowledge is there. And if everybody wants to come together and we want to build a centralized lab somewhere that has basically a network of computers coming from my house to in your house and all that, where we can Skype in and talk to each other. If I can't physically be there at the moment, then I can at least assist in the process by throwing my two cents in. You see what I mean?
Yes, I do.
And I don't care where the lab ends up being, and really don't care what kind of shape. I think it'd be kind of cool to have a giant geodesic dome that had a spaceship kind of feel to it, or, you know, to boldly go where no man's gone before kind of thing. And just make it a fun event that is educational for people. And, you know, science classes could look in and see. This is what we're doing with our knowledge of what we've learned from physics and science. What do you think?
And our great-grandfathers.
Yep.
I learned a lot from my grandfather just by sitting on the porch, listening to him playing guitar, and then he'd stop and he'd tell me about things that he did when he was a young man, and I'm thinking to myself, wow. You know, I've said this before on the same program. My grandfather, when he was a young man, his job was building lumber mills back in the days when they didn't have asphalt and concrete to build highways with. All your roads were dirt roads, and it was cheaper to build the lumber mill in the center of the forest, cut the trees into lumber, load them on wagons, and pull them by horses and mules away. Nowadays, we have highways, so we cut the trees down, put them on trucks, and haul them to the lumber mill. Now, my point is not the lumber mill. My point is, how did they power the lumber mill? They powered it with gasoline. But no, they didn't either. They had an engine that burnt the fumes off the gasoline. They would put 10 or 15 gallons of gasoline in a 200-gallon drum, and then they'd set out in the sun and run their gasoline engine off the fumes. They could run a sawmill 10 to 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, for a month on less than 15 gallons of gasoline.
Well, that's what I'm talking about, efficiency. You know, they burned wood gas back in World War I or World War II. I can't remember which one, probably both, because when it was hard to get fuel, they figured out ways that they can make a wood gasifier to run an internal combustion engine. We're burning diesel, we're burning everything in the sun, you know? And all we're doing is actually just changing the energy long enough to get the work done that we want. We know what happens when you ignite fuel, and so we use that process. And a lot of the processes they have a lot of waste energy because the energy is so abundant. It's massive. You see what I'm saying? I mean, like, running your internal combustion engine, if you ain't got certain systems on that thing will literally destroy itself. It'll create so much heat, waste heat, that it will literally lock that engine up. It'll break down the viscosity of the oil, and it will literally begin to destroy the parts inside that motor. It'll get so doggone hot that it will literally seize that motor up solid. And so with that said, you got to have a radiator on there, you got to have a fan on there, you got to have some sort of lubricating coolant going through there, you know, to keep bearings in the water pump from going bad or whatever, you know, and keep that water circulated. In the process, they figured out that they could use some of that waste heat to heat the inside of the car or the vehicle, whatever, while you're driving the car. But during the summertime, you obviously don't want your heater on there. So they figured out ways to, basically take some of the energy off the engine to turn a compressor, which then in turn compresses the gas, and then that gas, expands back out, creates a cooling effect, and they built an air conditioner. But there ain't no reason why you couldn't build a heat exchanger to be the air conditioner on the deal. What do you think?
You're exactly right. There's no reason you couldn't, yep, other than the fact you don't think you can.
Well, and so with all that said, if we could bring the right crew together, and I've been shouting this to all four points of the compass for several years now, trying to explain to people that, you know, we can do this thing. We got all the information that we need. We know how static electricity works. Now, when you get down into the micro of the electron and the magnetic field. Now, nobody can explain, you know, exactly what magnetism is or exactly what gravity is or whatever, but we do know from physical observation, which we call science, that these certain effects are what they classify as the laws of physics, and these anomalies right here get work done. And using these in a smart manner, you know, boiling water, pressurizing it into steam, you know, we can turn turbines, cavitating the water, spinning the water around, we can actually turn that water into steam by heating that water up just by spinning it around. causing its own water hammer and such. So, we can spin the water, make the steam, turn the turbines, which turns the generator, which makes the electricity, and use some of that electricity to separate some of that water into its separate molecules, such as hydrogen and oxygen, and then turn around and burn that water like a pilot light on the initial system that was actually heating it up to actually be able to maintain that water to the operating temperature that it takes to actually produce the steam, and then turn around from that point on, be able to back off the electricity input that we put on there and make it so super efficient it barely takes any energy to keep it running. That's what I'm talking about. You see what I mean? I mean, it's not rocket science. It's simple science. It's been around since, at the very least, the 1800s. And all the way through the entire Industrial Revolution, people had found creative ways to use everything under the sun. And, you know, the mercury arc rectifier, that was an amazing piece of equipment. It turned high voltage AC into high voltage rectified DC that would run big old high voltage DC elevator motors that Edison had in place.
You know, you said something pretty stinking profound, but you kind of like glided over it real quick. And that is the simplicity of science. When science is complicated, it's because you don't understand it. And you're trying to do things that are literally impossible. So therefore, it becomes complicated. But when you truly understand what science is, all it is nature doing its thing. Then it becomes super simple. And then you start working with it instead of against it.
Yep.
And a perfect example of what I'm talking about, it will sound like it has nothing to do with what we're talking about. But in reality, it is. And that is this red algae in the Gulf. Every 7 years, red algae comes out, and all the fishermen and all the shrimpers are crying the blues. I mean, come on, man. Use Mother Nature. It's algae.
Yeah.
Algae is 40 to 45% vegetable oil. Vegetable oil is better diesel fuel than diesel.
Yeah, as soon as you see it, come out there and vacuum it up.
Vacuum it up. Take it in. 15, 20 of you fishermen, you shrimpers, get together. Put a few dollars together. Buy an oil extractor. Buy a vegetable oil extractor. Every 7 years, you go out there, you harvest this red algae, you turn it into vegetable oil, and you run your diesel engines on your boat for the next 6 years.
Yep. You get your old oil tanker and suck it right up into the oil tanker, fill the holes up, and then take it right and use that for fuel, man.
Yes, I mean, don't cry about, I mean, when the life gives you lemons, make lemonade. Duh.
I've been thinking about this for a long time. Hedge trees produce, there's oil in the wood, all right? Well, if you've ever seen a hedge apple, those things are like really sticky as all get out. But I want to do some experiments, and if anybody out there's already done some experiments with hedge apples or hedge balls, whatever you call them, they're big old green apples. The deer's kind of like to chew on them. I don't know why. Maybe they taste good or something, but I ain't never tried to taste one. And I know they're good for bugs or whatever like that. You're supposed to be able to cut them in half, and they'll chase spiders away. But what I want to find out is if some of the oil that is like trapped in the wood of the hedge tree itself is actually transferred into the hedge ball, and whether or not you could actually refine that and make a fuel or even a glue out of it for that matter.
Okay, let me clarify something. What you're talking about is a podar tree.
A what?
A lot of people in the Midwest call them horse apples.
Horse apples, hedge apples, or...
But podar was actually one of the most favorite trees of the American Indians for their arrows. Because once it's dry, it's almost like locust wood. It's extremely hard. And once it's dry, whatever it dries shape in, that's what it's going to be for the rest of eternity. The wood is so hard that once it cures out, bugs won't even eat it. It doesn't rot.
Yeah. That's why they use hedge for fence posts.
Exactly.
And that stuff is like you ever want to make a ball bat that ain't going to break, make it out of hedge. Some people call it Missouri orange. It not only looks good, but it'll be sturdy.
It's got a lot of nicknames all over the world.
Yeah, you ever try to break a hedge stick? Don't try to break it over your leg. Your leg's going to give before that stick does.
That's for sure.
So where'd Thomas go? Did his microphone die out on us? Thomas, you still there? Did you take a nap? Did you go to sleep?
I'm just listening to you guys.
He probably got tired of us ranting and raving.
Are we off key there, brother?
No, I had my little rant and rave last night with a friend of mine, and my throat's kind of worn out, so unless it's something important, I'm kind of keeping my mouth shut.
Oh, okay. So, do you know anything about hedge apples or horse apples or whatever Raymond called them a second ago?
Somebody told me you have to force them to do it because they don't like doing it, but horses, if they eat it, that's basically the equivalent of a person eating oranges or something like that. They get their citrus from it, vitamin C, stuff like that. It's good for them.
So, I wonder if it's got citrus in it, I wonder if you could make a battery out of those dang things.
That's a good thought.
I need to go out there after this show and I need to plug in a nickel and a penny into a doggone hedge apple and put my voltmeter on it.
I'd like to see that.
I'll put my voltmeter on everything, man.
Put a little recording of it up on YouTube, man.
Yeah, that'd be a good idea.
While you're at it, get yourself a Daily Motion account and monetize both of them, man.
Hedge
put that
apple
money toward
battery.
Your research.
Hedge apple battery. I might have to say it comes by multiple names. Hedge apples, horse apples. But anyway, I'm going to make myself a note right now while we're talking and make sure I do that right after the show. I'm gonna go out there and do that experiment because I never knew they had citrus in it. But I know you can do that with a lemon. Man. Yep, I'm away from the microphone grabbing an ink pen.
That's what I said, when life gives you lemons, make lemonade.
Yeah, that's what got me thinking about the doggone hedge apple. And then when Thomas said that the hedge apples are a source of citrus for horses, then if you got citrus, you got acid, which... You can make a electrolyte style battery, a chemical battery. Yep, there we go, man. And I got tons of these around here, so see how many of them, how much voltage you could get off of one, and see if you could run them in series to get more voltage on there. I might have enough hedge apples on my property to run a light bulb or something cool. What do you think?
I think you might have enough to hit not just light bulb, but take LED and light your whole daggone yard up.
Yeah, and might as well get some use out of them doggone things before the deer eat them all up or the bugs. So.
You gonna start reporting here to death?
No, they can just come over and eat off the doggone the battery bank.
Get a charge out of that, right?
Yeah. Look, it's like this. When I see an anomaly or hear a possibility, such as I know that when I was a kid, they did experiments in school with lemons and grapefruits, and we put nickels and pennies in there, and we actually made batteries out of them. And so once I heard Thomas say that there was a source of citrus in there, that was enough for me to know that I want to do an experiment to see if I could actually get a charge off of that thing. And hedge apples are pretty big, so if you can put the right size plates in the center of those, you should get a pretty good battery out of it.
Yeah, but don't get greedy and starve your deer to death.
No, I wouldn't do that.
I love you, man.
Yeah, well, I'm gonna do that whenever I get off of this show today. That's brilliant. I got some copper and some maybe I'll use some pipe strap because it's got some galvanized in it and see what kind of reaction I get. Anyway, that's how science works, man. And some folks out there classify themselves as merely tinkerers and don't don't want to give themselves I'm a study scientist or I'm a scientist or whatever. You don't even have to be a scientist, but tinkerers is the ones I like the most because they'll try it before they deny it, that kind of thing. You know, and some of the guys that are supposedly super educated will look at it and they'll say, oh, well, no, that'll never work. You can't do it because of this. Well, have you tried it? No, but physics says. Of course physics says. Physics says you can't do a lot of stuff, and then these guys turn around and build stuff that proves them wrong, and then they have to rewrite the book a bit. That's what I like, man. Question it all. You know, I'm not saying you got to be a radical and, you know, try to violate the laws of physics. I'm just saying use what you've learned to get it done, to make it as efficient as humanly possible. Ain't nothing wrong with that. A lot of people listened back in the day, we wouldn't even have electricities or cars, internal combustion engines. People, they didn't like electricity when it first came around. It looked like it was too dangerous, or it was like witchcraft or something. They didn't understand it.
Do you realize that if OSHA had been formed before electricity was invented, that electricity would be outlawed today?
Wouldn't surprise me in the least. Because a lot of these government agencies, like the EPA, y'all know how I feel about them. Dump crud down somebody's
river. Oh, come on, government agency. Get this one, okay? This is a true story. When Obama first took office as president, he insisted the automobile industry build a more efficient automobile, gas mileage and so forth and so on. So he started this commission, these people, to get together to sit down and talk to all the automobile engineers. And they said, well, we want you to build a car that will do this, 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 and this. And this head spokesman for the engineers stood up and said, well, it was a woman that was the head of the government agency. And he said, ma'am, do you realize that you're asking us to defy the laws of physics? She stood up and said, do you realize that we are the government and we will just simply change the law? That's the thought. Thank you for you.
Now, I agree that they could actually make cars a heck of a lot more efficient, and there is reasoning why they don't make them a heck of a lot more efficient. Because if you burn more fuel, you sell more fuel. And obviously, you don't want a car that's going to get several hundred miles to the gallon, because you ain't going to be able to sell the fuel at the price that you want. And the government loves the taxes off of those cars. And the fuel industry loves the money that they get off of fuel. So with that said, you're up against the wall when it comes to stuff like this. Now, as far as the so-called EPA saying that, you know, you got to make things more environmentally friendly, such as throw a catalytic converter and a smog control on your car, which is actually counterproductive to what that car could do if it was designed right to begin with, then to be more efficient. But the smog control, those things get clogged up and they make your car run like crud, which even when it's running like crud, the catalytic converter ain't going to make no difference. You're still going to get cruddy exhaust out the back because it's bypassing everything. And so if you build it efficient to begin with, then you won't have to worry about that wasted fuel being reburnt inside the catalytic converter, and you won't have to worry about the smog control pump getting crudded up.
Amen. You don't put a band-aid on a cut.
Yeah.
The cut.
So
that's all a catalytic converter is. It's a band-aid.
If you took and you built a filtration system that would literally still allow the air to breathe as far as the you know, a chimney on a smokestack like a wood burning stove has to be able to draft. It has to be able to vent. But there's methods by which you could actually filter out any particulates that come through there, which are going to be essentially like carbon, all right? And you could turn that filter into a fuel source right after it finally gets plugged up. You have a system that will vent the air off into a secondary stack, And when you see smoke coming out of that secondary stack, you know it's now time to replace that filter. And so when you replace that filter and the air draft is good enough where it'll allow air to flow through there to allow the furnace to run safely, then you will take that doggone air filter out of the stack, run around the front, throw it in there where you threw the logs, and burn it again. What do you think of that?
I like it.
Why can't you? It's essentially the same material, just kind of broke down into smaller particulates. So
the only reason you can't, there's only one reason you cannot do that, and that is if you believe that you can.
Well, I believe you can do it because I've seen what happens when creosote builds up in the doggone stack. It'll literally clog a stack up and pressurize to the point where now you got a super cannon that explodes out of the top, hot burning creosote. Burn your doggone house down if you don't keep up on it. So, you know, if that will do that effect, then why can't you capture that creosote in a material that you can then in turn pull it up out of that doggone stack and then reburn that fuel? And then, hey, it helps the whole save the tree thing, because now you're not cutting as much firewood anymore. What do you think?
Perfect. Absolutely perfect. It could be done. It can be done. You clean your creosote out of your chimney, and you break it up in little pieces and slowly throw it in your fire, and it will burn.
Yep.
And it will not burn in your chimney. By the way, just for safety's sake, does anybody out there know the best way to put a chimney fire out? You throw a cup of water in the fireplace.
So
the water turns into steam and starves the chimney fire from oxygen. Puts the fire right out without any explosion.
Well, that's a good one, because I would have loved to known that a long time ago. I didn't think about it, but that's why the doggone fire went out, because I had a chimney fire go on in mine, and I ran around, grabbed the garden hose, and shoved it up inside there, and man, you should have seen the steam come rolling off of there. The fire went right out.
Yep. Steam will put a fire out.
Well, see that? Now not only can you start a fire with water, but you can put the fire out with water. It's all how you use it, man.
I've said it 3 times and I'll say it again. When life gives you lemons, make lemonade.
Yep. So, we've thrown a lot of brilliant ideas on the table. We've actually thrown a pretty huge invitation out there for researchers. And I don't care, even if you think you got a small YouTube channel and you don't think that your research is up to par with everybody else, or you think somebody's way multitude steps ahead of you as far as their knowledge or terminology on something. If you're any kind of researcher in any kind of field out there having to do with energy or, you know, alternative stuff like that, then I want to hear from you. I want to see the mad scientists, the garage scientists, the garage mechanics, and excuse me. There are people out there they call shade tree mechanics in this world. And if you want to learn some tricks about how to do things with less without the funds, or be able to engineer something to work that normally wouldn't work unless you put a replacement part on there, go talk to these guys. Go down to a salvage yard and talk to one of them old junkyard dogs that's been working in the salvage yard for years. They'll show you things on how to do things that are passed down from one guy to the next, of things that they found out during their research while working on vehicles and such. Easier ways to get things done. You would be surprised at what you can learn from somebody who doesn't think that they're as educated as you are. You see what I'm talking about, man? Yeah.
The dumbest person on the face of this earth knows something you don't know.
Yep. And the lazy folks can show you easier ways to do stuff. Maybe not necessarily the best way, but easier ways. I I would rather hire a crew of lazy people that had some intelligence to them that would want to use their brain instead of their back to find new ways to actually do stuff, not only faster, but in their quest to be lazy, they would make the job so easier that you wouldn't have to have near as many employees to do it in the future. You see what I'm saying?
Yep.
So they would be essentially lazy in their way out of a job eventually. So I don't know, man. Where there's a will, there's a way. What do you say I play this podcast and we take a quick music break? It's about a 17 minute podcast that has to do with that.
Hear, hear.
That Dale Pond explains John Keeley's water implosion device. This link
go
is
get
in
you
the chat.
A peppermint or something, man.
Yeah. I'm about to choke to death. That's what happens when you talk too much.
You said you'd keep going until you were hoarse if no one ever caught on.
Yeah. That's what I was. I'm praying to God that you all would jump in there real soon and like take it over, man. Run amok or something. Start an argument amongst each other.
I thought this was Mad Science. I didn't think it was Jerry Springer.
Well, it could be like a combination Mad Science, Jerry Springer, you guys arguing over physics. But that ain't how it works. Well, I'll say it is, and so on. You know what I'm saying.
We'll change the law.
We'll change the laws of physics. They'll have
We're the government. We'll change the law.
If they had a jail cell for people trying to break the laws of physics, that thing would be full of mad scientists. Alright.
They don't bad for nothing, and they ain't crazy. That's what we are.
Alright, we're going
to try it.
We're going to play this 17 minute pod, and I'm going to go get something to drink and try to breathe again. Alright, so stay tuned. You're listening to Mad Science, everybody. Peace and love.
To one of Keeley's lawyers in the late 1800s. We assume it was given to him, or it was part payment or whatever, we don't know exactly. A Mr. Housen. Later on, he donated this to the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia, and it sat in the Franklin Institute for 50 years. And they had a little sign on it that said it was a perpetual motion machine. Well, it was not a perpetual motion machine. They called it that because they didn't know what it was or how it worked, or they didn't have any idea about it. They just call it perpetual motion. And my friend Victor Hansen, who is in the other room, he owns this machine. He bought it from the Franklin Institute for $1,000. Took him 8 years to get the money together to pay for it. He eventually got it and took it home. And he had it since the 40s. So he's had it for another 50 years. 3 or 4 years ago, I had a chance to look at it for the first time, and if any of you are engineers and you look at this thing, you say it is absolutely bizarre. There's no way this thing can work, because in conventional male-oriented physics, where we put in energy, we got to hit it with something. You know, this makes no sense because it doesn't operate with that philosophy. It operates with the female forces of implosion, so the thing kind of operates backwards. And when you look at it a little bit and you say, well, this thing operates backwards, and then all of a sudden your mind just gets all clouded and confused because you're not used to thinking in those terms. But after a while, it gets kind of simple. And this is brilliant. If Keeley did anything, he was a brilliant machinist and a brilliant mechanic. He just had a cleverness of making things. Water would come in through this orifice. Once you got the thing primed with water in the system, he could just kind of crank, give this thing a little crank, and it would create a vacuum, and the water would draw itself through the machine. Now, one interesting concept is the water formed a part of the mechanism. That's not normal for that. That's not normal engineering. We don't normally do that, where the water is actually part of the motion of the machine. So this thing is kind of like a holistic machine. It's not a machine operating on the water or the water operating on a machine. It's the water and the machine operating together as a whole unit. Kind of like the human body does. So I give this thing a crank. Water will come into here above this level, this tube, this horizontal tube that goes across the front. The tube goes through this pulsating chamber. I call this a pulsating chamber. And the tubes are hollow. There's nothing inside of them. The same thing with this tube. It's just a straight tube. There are holes in the center so that it has access to the internal volume of this pulsating chamber. This chamber is 1/64th of an inch in thickness. It is red brass. It's very hard, very resonant type brass, whereas this is a yellow brass. It's red brass, kind of like a naval brass. And the interesting thing is, once the water came into this and started through the system, this chamber would begin to pulsate. And because it's mostly got air in it, we would have a pulsation of a high and low pressure forming at intervals, very high frequency. So this becomes a pump. Once the water is in motion, this pulsating chamber becomes a pump with no moving parts. It's really ingenious. Just a year ago, I ran across a NASA paper where these guys, some engineer didn't even have his name on the paper, had designed a waveguide using a transducer, and he had developed a pump using a transducer, there again with no moving parts. So here was a validation from NASA that this concept works. And I thought that was really good that we ran into that paper. In these two mechanisms, one on each side, these are check valves. The water would come across horizontally and start up through this check valve, and all it is a round ball sitting on a round hole. So water could come this way, but it can't go back down. Then the water would come through these pipes around here, there's two on each side, into these pistons. Now there's two kinds of pistons. This is kind of an enigma why there's two distinct designs on these pistons. They are not the same. In this left side, your right side, we have what we consider a standard piston arrangement. Underneath, we have a bar that goes underneath that pushes a piston up into this larger chamber. The water would come into the top of that cylinder, on top of that piston. And in the end, there's a valve that goes straight through here. It's a rotary valve, so it just rotates. In this case, it just rocks back and forth. So the water could come through that cylinder. When the valve got in the right place, the water would shoot through into this cylinder, pushing this crankshaft and causing it to rotate. It's real simple. However, the things that go on while it's doing all that is really neat. The pulsations would drive the water past the check valves into this cylinder down here, pushing this rod down, which lifted this weight on the far side here. So it would lift this weight on the far side, thereby putting pressure on this water in this cylinder. So here we've got water under tremendous pressure because the injections of the pulsating waves pounding that water. The minute the little rocker arm rocked the valve back and forth, we've got a high velocity stream of water coming past the valve. So when you close the valve on high velocity water, what do you get? You get a water hammer. You get that pounding. And water hammer is when you close the faucet in your sink and the pipes bang in your basement. That's water hammer. There's infinite pressure in that. So that pressure, I did a computer model of what happens in here. Of course, computer model is based on ideal conditions, which this isn't. But I was surprised that it showed within eight cycles of this valve opening and closing, the pressure goes to infinity. Now that's an ideal situation, which this isn't. So we got the high-speed stream of water coming through the valve system, pushing this piston up, and would cause a little bit of rotation. And on the other side, there's two types of water hammer, by the way. There's upstream and downstream. Water coming into a valve. You shut the valve, that water has a momentum that keeps going against the valve. And the reverberation of this shockwave going back upstream, away from the valve, creates a pocket of negative pressure, low pressure, vacuum, which will collapse as you impose, causing a pounding. On the downstream side, the water wants to keep going, so it creates another vacuum, which collapses and causes another shockwave. So if we time that shockwave back and forth on either side of the valve, it goes upstream up the pipe, and then it comes back down. If you open the valve at the same time that reverberation of the shockwave comes back, it will add to the original one. It's like a child on a swing. You push a child on a swing. If you push it at the right moment, it'll get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And by the way, that is the same principle that Morey used in his valve assemblies in the 1930s and 40s, where he caused an oscillation of electrical current. It's much like Bearden talks about today with scalar electromagnetics, where they got biphilic coils and they got this tremendous charge of current, not current, but potential, that they oscillate back and forth. So we've created a potential in here, and we oscillate it back and forth, and the valve lets loose just enough to keep the mechanism going. On the other side, there is a slightly different, it's fundamentally different thing happening. Because this piston down here does not capture water. It is a round ball sitting in a round hole. So when the water squirts through here, it hits on top of this ball and then goes immediately all over the place. But while it does that, it creates a vaporized situation on top of that sphere, and it polarizes the water. Right above the round portion, we have a little chamber in here. It's a little square chamber, and that bothered me for 2 years, what this chamber was all about, because it's a rectangular hole going through this little chamber, that when the ball closes, it closes one end of it, and when the valve closes, the other end of it's closed. And I got to thinking about waveguides and whatnot. This thing is a waveguide. When both the valve and the piston are open, we have a certain fundamental frequency. When one or the other closes, the frequency goes up nearly four times. And I think that's in my paper. When that happens, based on the dimensions of this waveguide, we have microwave frequencies in operation on this water vapor. Microwave frequencies from a mechanical mechanism is absolutely incredible. So we get this water vapor in here and we microwave. What happens when you microwave water? So we get a high potential expansion rate of the water going through this valve and driving this piston. So we've got two different drive mechanisms working on this little motor. So the guy was a genius. There's no doubt about it. And this was a machine he gave up on. He went on to better and more higher things that we're only now beginning to get any kind of idea about. Any questions on this motor or the water phenomenon or the cavitation, the water hammer?
Can you fire it up?
No, it's not operational. It was about 2 years ago when I finally hit on the idea that it was water hammer. We did change some of the pipes because they were all split and broken and some of the joints were broken. We soldered those up and we put new gaskets in it. And we put it in a bathtub and we ran a little bit of water into it. And it was kind of phenomenal what happened. The thing like it came alive. But it didn't operate as we think it should operate. And we feel that's because of the timing mechanism in these valves. We don't understand those yet. So we really didn't know how to deal with those. And first and foremost is this is an original priceless antique. We didn't want to mess with it very much. Just enough to see if my idea was correct about the water hammer, which we did prove and verify. So eventually, if we ever get to any money, we're going to exactly duplicate this thing, and then we can play with that model all we want to. You had a question?
Raise your hand if you have a question so I can get it on mic. All right, let's go ahead.
What would it cost to produce one of those machines?
I think machinist time is about between $30 and $60 an hour. It would take a lot of money. It'd take several thousands of dollars, just machine work, to duplicate it. Now, another idea is once we know the principles of how this thing works, we can design our own from scratch using electronic valves so we get rid of the friction phenomena and all that kind of stuff. And I think we do understand it enough to design our own from scratch. And I do have some designs that I've worked with. I've got various devices that I've been working on the designs of that we may be able to build. Yes, sir.
Have you heard of the 300-mile-an-hour submarine? A gentleman, I believe it was in the 50s, built one as a one-man submarine. He crossed the Atlantic Ocean in about 24 hours, something like that. But I think he was using a turbine. But a turbine could be set up to use the cavitation principle. Mm-hmm. Each blade of the turbine would be making a cavitation.
Okay. That's a very good question. No, I haven't heard of that particular machine or that event. Using turbines is very interesting because the Tesla turbine, for instance, where you have the smooth discs, I have a model of it over on the workbench over there, on the book table. When it draws water in, if the velocity of that draw exceeds a certain point, the water cavitates, and it will cease to draw. Any pump will do that, can create that phenomenon. So you can only draw water in at a certain given velocity. However, I believe the same thing happens with air in jet engines. They can cavitate and they'll flame out and all that kind of stuff. But any fluid will do that. So certain designs, like the Schauberger material, seem to indicate that we can supersede, we can increase that ability, or we can push back that threshold of cavitation to a great extent and thereby increase velocities and attain those things that you're referring to. I believe Keeley was doing some of that work too. Although there is another way propelling a craft or a mechanism that is not male-oriented. And we can get into that too. Remind me of that now, we'll cross into that. You have a question?
Yeah, the opposing counterweights, what do they do? Is it perhaps that one motor goes for a while and then the other side goes? Where those counterweights come up and down?
That's part of the questions we haven't answered in this particular design. We know that this weight maintains a pressure against this piston. This is what maintains the pressure within this cylinder, so that when this valve opens, it has that velocity to the water stream. This one over here maintains this piston closed. So when the water ejects against it, there's a certain resistance to the water stream. And I thought, well, why couldn't we use spring-loaded mechanism instead of these weights? And there is a different reaction to these weights coming down as opposed to a spring mechanism. And also in the 1880s, they didn't have the materials we got today, so he probably couldn't build a good spring like we can today. So there's many different questions. We don't have them all answered. You know, we've got the basic phenomenon figured out, but why did he do this and do that and not the other thing, we can only conjecture. And the timing, each cylinder has its own timing and how they work, plus the timing in the timing gears.
Comment on the spring. The acceleration from a spring is totally different from the acceleration of a released weight. So you wouldn't get an instantaneous switch or as rapid a switch. It would be a more gradual switch. So a spring would have a totally different mechanical phenomenology. And if you're opening and closing a valve, that's probably the best way.
Yeah, I agree with that. That's kind of what I came up with. I had built a model of this cylinder, and I used a spring because I didn't want to build all this mechanical stuff, just to prove that I could capture pressure with water hammer, and it did do that. So we can do those things. And I think if we had more engineering expertise working on this problem, we'd come up with all kinds of solutions to it.
Yeah, Dale, you said that you'd only find two books on cavitation.
Right.
Do you think the level of knowledge in physics right now is sufficient for you to be able to model the cavitation effect of this machine, say?
Yeah.
For example, you think that the theoretical development in physics, the level is high enough right now? Do all the concepts that we need to involve here present in physics sufficiently that we might be able to mathematically model this machine?
Easily.
You think so?
Easily, yeah. This what goes on in here once you start to model it is real simple. It is echoes of shock waves and things like that. We know a lot about shock waves.
About shock waves, yeah.
And water hammer is a study of these shock waves within a given mechanism, you know, water pipes. So that's where the breakdown occurs, is when you try and take the mathematical formula for water hammer and apply it to this engine. Well, it starts breaking down because those are designed for water tubing and piping and whatnot, and this isn't. So we've got to modify them to a certain degree to bring them into coincidence with what goes on here. But I do not think that what is happening here is beyond our current technology. Now, this negative attraction stuff, it...
Crap!
Operator, give me the number for 911.
Yeah, give me the number for 911 too, man. Alright, well, during that podcast, while that was playing out, I was rushing around while Raymond and Thomas was having a good conversation, and I grabbed a hold of a hedge ball. Alright, well, I took and put a galvanized nail in it and a piece of copper wire, house kind of wire, the solid strand of copper wire, and I'm looking down at my voltmeter, and it says 0.63 of a volt. So I got 0.63 volts off of this thing right now, a hedge ball.
To this,
yeah.
Get a hammer and flatten that copper wire out so you have more surface area. I think it'll increase your voltage.
Yeah, that's why I was thinking about putting a larger plate on the other side. But
did you check your amperage?
No.
Check your amperage.
I got to figure out how to use this voltmeter. BCN. 55.2.
Do what? Say that again.
Well, I got it on DC amp, and it says 50, now it's, right now it's 51.5.
You sure that's not milliamps?
Yeah. Well, it probably is. I can't. No,
it's on the 200 range of it. Look, think about this a minute. If it's 50 amps at 0.6 volts, 6 times 50 is 300, you're talking 30 watts here.
Well, right there it says, I got it on the 2000 range on the DCA, it's not on the milliamp side. And it says 0.54.
Okay, right. That's more like it. But you're getting 54 milliamps.
No, it's not the milliamps. It's on the high voltage portion of it.
Yeah, but you're getting 0.54.
No, it's 54. If I shift it over to the other side, it's 4.5 amps.
That is putting out a lot of wattage.
How's that possible out of a hedge apple?
Holy cow. You put a couple of, two or three, maybe four of those in series, you can light up 100 LEDs with that.
Well, I'm getting over a half a volt just by... It's on DC voltage right now. I'm getting over half a volt just by what I got plugged into it right now.
So you put five of them together, you can get right at 3 volts, which would light up a LED. And with the amperage that you're getting, you'd probably light up anywhere from 75 to 100 LEDs.
I'll tell you what, I'll do a video and I'll show the voltmeter because that way I'm not misquoting what it's showing on there. You'll see exactly what it says.
Right.
And I'll use a larger copper plate. Maybe I'll smash down a copper pipe, a little piece of copper pipe, and make a plate for that side and a different one for the other.
That's cool.
But I'm leaving this one going right now. It fluctuates between point. It's right now it's at 0.60 volts.
Wow.
That's pretty impressive for a hedge ball.
Really, it is. Real impressive.
And I didn't use a really big copper wire on the other side. I just used there's probably about maybe an inch and a half piece of wire that I stuck down in there partially. The galvanized nail's in further. It's at 0.62 right now. So there's definitely something going on there. So, there you go, man. Free energy right there from a hedge ball. What do you think?
I like it. That's really great. I'm just wondering if you took a flat sheet of copper and a flat sheet of galvanized and cut that horse apple into little pieces and put it in a blender turn it into a puree, and then put a layer of that between the galvanized and the copper sheet. I wonder how much amperage you get then. You wouldn't get any more voltage, but you'd get a lot of amperage, boy.
Well, it'd be worth a try.
Yes, it is. That's really cool.
I'm going to see if, I don't know if, how much it actually takes to light a doggone LED. See if I can light an LED with that thing. Anyway, there was an experiment live on there. I'll have to do a video this afternoon about it. But, yeah, electricity, energy comes from some of the craziest places, man. Everything out there is energy. Just matters how you want to use it. That's all I've been saying all this time.
You said it over 1,000 times. I'm going to say it again. if you can't find free energy, you're just plain not looking.
Yep.
Oh, Lord.
So I'm going to call that a redneck battery.
There you go.
Horse apple and a freaking couple pieces of metal. I'm going to put a capacitor on there. And I'm also going to put... See if I can put a little blinking LED on there. See if that doggone thing will light up. Yeah. What do you think?
I bet it will. I bet it will.
So, somebody keep talking because I'm in the process of doing an experiment.
Live on the air.
Yeah.
Yes, this is laboratory with an actual experiment. Man is a genius.
Okay, it's negative side. Talk, man, talk, we're live.
I don't know what to say. I'm sitting here waiting to hear the results. I want to hear you go, ouch. I love it when you jump, when you get shocked. I mean, you know, for an old man, you lose pretty quick.
But what I'm trying to find out right now is if doggone, if this thing will charge the capacitor.
All right.
Hey, man, you get tired of putting your plug into the socket and it bends the prong? Take a fork and stick it in there and straighten out that socket, man.
There you go. Yeah. There you go. You talk about acid taking on electricity, just spit on the first, then grab the fork.
Get a free Shazam's hairdo.
Yeah.
Yep.
Free Shazam's hairdo with every free energy device. Well, the capacitor so far has brought it up to 0.66. So over a half a volt just by adding a capacitor.
Wow. That's cool.
And it's, yeah, and it's staying steady. It's not fluctuating anymore. It's staying steady at 0.66.
Wow.
Out of a hedge apple, man.
Did you get more than one? So you could hook them in series?
No, I was in a hurry, man. I was rushing around trying to get everything done, man. Who got time to carry a bunch of hedge balls? It went up to 0.67.
Uh-oh. That sounds great.
It's charging the capacitor.
Fantastic.
This is cool, man.
Yes, it is.
Keep an eye on that for the rest of the Mad Science Show to see how it plays out.
All right.
Say hi to Ed, everybody. Ed's over there in the Awake radio chat room. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Ed.
Man, I swear, you guys are deadbeats, man. You guys got to learn how to, like, jaw jack too much or something. Just jump in there and butt in or something.
All right. While we're on break, folks, and you guys were listening to the podcast, Thomas and I got talking about a tree he told me about. His nickname is the Diesel Tree. And the actual name is, where did I see that at? Basically comes from Brazil in South America, and you can tap this tree and drain the sap out of it, and it use it directly, right, just like it is, just strain it, and it will use as diesel fuel. Anyway, they say that It doesn't store very well, and that after 3 months it starts to gel, but yet that gel can be turned into medicines and is worth about $100 a liter. The tree actually produces about 70 liters a year, and I've got the website pulled up here. Oh, there it is. The actual name is C-O-P-A-I-B-A. Okay? And they can grow in southern Florida, and there is an outfit in Australia that is actually experimenting growing it down there. And a lot of the farmers are hoping that they grow it on their land and become diesel fuel free. Oh, let's see, 25 barrels of fuel. Okay, yeah. It's an amazing tree, and it's a pretty tree, too. Really pretty. Oh, and once it starts producing diesel fuel, it will produce for 70 years.
Cool.
Real interesting. Huh.
Fuel out of the tree, man.
There we go.
See?
And when it dies, you got a lot of lumber.
He just told you how to get fuel out of a tree and lumber, and I just showed you how, I told you how to take a doggone hedge ball, horse apple, or whatever that other terminology that Raymond was using, and right now it's shifting over to 0.68 volts, charging that capacitor. Doggone it. I was always trying to find a use for those doggone hedge balls.
Okay, here it says, okay, I was wrong about the 70 liters. It's, one tree will produce roughly 40 liters of diesel fuel a year. And, let's see, about 12,000 liters per hectare. Now, a hectare is European and, South American, measurement for, actually metric measurement for an acre. And, 1 hectare is 2.2 acres. So, 2.2 acres will produce 12,000 liters per year if you planted it all in this tree. That's a lot of fuel, and it's natural.
We're staying steady at 0.68 volts. And also, while you were talking, I took a flathead screwdriver and shorted across the terminals, and it dropped down to about 60.60. And then jumped right back up to 0.68 when I took the screwdriver off. So I damn shorted it.
Whoa, that is impressive, she says. That's very impressive. Shorted it out and it jumped back up that fast?
Yep.
Holy cow.
Cool.
Oh, by the way, folks, what got Thomas and I talking about this diesel tree is I was telling him about the Jatropha tree that grows in Mexico. And actually, the seed, it has a fruit. It grows on the tree about the size of a tennis ball, and inside of it are three large seeds, and the seeds are about 45% vegetable oil. Now, India got a bunch of seeds, and here in the past 10, 12 years, planted 1 billion hectares of Jatropha trees, and they were so successful that when they finished, they instantly started planting another million hectares. So that's going to be roughly 4.4 million acres of Jatropha trees, which grows a natural diesel fuel. I mean, wow. And the beautiful part about this tree is it has an extremely deep root system. It goes really deep in the ground and pulls minerals from down deep, brings it to the surface. The minerals help grow the leaves on the tree. Then in the fall, when the leaves die off and fall to the ground, they rot and improve the fertilizer on the ground, natural fertilizer, not compost. Now, here is the best part about the Jatropha tree. It will grow where corn, soybeans, and wheat will not grow. Jatropha is so hardy, it will grow in the crack of a rock. It will grow on the poorest land on the planet. All it needs is a minimum of 10 inches of rainfall a year to grow and produce a crop. The more rainfall it gets, the more crops per year it will produce. At 10 to 12 inches, it will produce 1 crop a year. At 18 to 20 inches, it will produce 2 crops of fruit a year. Each crop is roughly 600 gallons of diesel fuel per acre. I mean, you know, the jatropha tree is, a lot of people know about it, but very few people are really into it. And it's amazing. It's really amazing. It will improve the soil. You can plant this stuff in the desert and it gets 10 or 15 inches of rain a year. And in a matter of time, it might take 10 or 15, 20 years, but you're going to turn that desert into beautiful farmland. Only thing is, you're only getting 10 or 12 inches of rain a year. But, you're not using that land now. Why not use it to grow diesel fuel?
Yeah. Well, the hedge ball battery is up to 0.69 volts. What do you think?
I love it.
And when I click it over to DC Amperage, it says 80, well, it's fluctuating between 70 to 80, that's 70, 71, it's fluctuating back and forth, up and down on the amperage side, and it's on the 200, is that ohm? I'm going to have to learn how to read that better. Either way, it's at 63.2 right now on the DC amperage side.
That is amazing.
And that's by shifting it over to that side, it dropped it down to 60, and now it's rising back up again. So, yep.
Doing an actual live experiment on Mad Science Radio. Wow, that is fantastic.
Well, I wish we had video right now. You could actually see this.
Yeah, that would be nice.
I'm going to do a video later on this afternoon and show everybody what I did. I'll go out and get several of them and see if I can run some in series and see how that acts as well. I'll use maybe 6 or 12 of them and run them in series. So, see how many bolts I can get out of them like that. But either way, heck, man, at worst case scenario, it's a survival deal you can charge a doggone cell phone up with out in the woods. As long as you got a piece of copper and a piece of galvanized with you.
Right.
What do you think?
Yep.
That's
so, the thing is, each horse apple, head apple, whatever you want to call it, each one is a cell. Now, you're not going to get any more voltage out of it, but by doing anything to it, it's a cell. But you can increase your amperage simply by increasing the surface area of your pieces of metal.
Well, if you run them in series, you'll double the voltage.
Oh, yeah. You increase the amperage by increasing the surface area of your metals, but you increase the voltage by hooking them in series.
Yeah. So, I'll try it both ways, one run in parallel, one run in series.
Hey, I got an idea. Take about 15 of them and hook them up in series, see if you can get up over 12 volts, and then charge the battery for them.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
Alright, so, wow. We've had a really interesting show, man. Even at the end here, it's kind of like got whacked because I'm distracted with the watching the voltage go up on this hedge ball. It's got a galvanized now and a piece of, I don't know if it's 18 gauge or what, the wiring that's actually in your wall.
Yeah.
Solid strand. And it's got maybe...
That's probably a 12 gauge.
Yeah, okay, 12 gauge then. Somewhere around about. Either way, just a short piece of solid wire and one nail inside there, so if I put some wider plates in there with more surface area, I should be able to get a little bit better results out of it.
Yeah. Hey, have you got any galvanized pipe like the EMT conduit?
Yeah.
All right, take a piece of that and just twist it back around, you know what I'm saying, back and forth, and shove it down in there so it gives you more surface area, and then a little piece of half-inch copper tubing.
Yeah.
And then twist it and chuck, and that's going to give you a lot of surface area. That's going to jump your average big time.
Cool.
Big time.
I'll do that. I got both of those over there at the shop, so I'll get some of that and do a video of it.
All right. and hook your fuckers in series, man.
This is exciting, man, because I've always been trying to figure out some sort of use for those other than bug repellent.
I can't see what you're doing, but I know exactly what you're doing. Well, from your description, and I've done similar things before, and I'm getting excited myself. I want to see the video.
Well, right now it's at 0.69 volts, and it's slowly charging that capacitor. So I'm anxious to just let this thing set and see how high it goes.
Don't blow the capacitor.
Well, if I blow the capacitor, that's even better, because then I know I need a larger capacitor.
There you go.
So, yeah, either way, that's pretty doggone good. If you can get a half a volt out of something like that, half a volt's add up.
That's super cool, man.
And the fact that I dead shorted the doggone thing and it rebounded so rapidly, that's pretty impressive, too. Because I literally took a screwdriver and shorted across the terminals to see if I could knock it all the way down, and it wouldn't go all the way down.
Wow.
It only went down to about 60. And the moment I took it off, it snapped back.
So your constant output is 60.
Yeah.
That's a constant output, because shorting it out, if it didn't go down below that, then that's what it's putting out at a constant rate.
Well, I don't know what all chemicals are actually in the hedge apple, but once Thomas said that there was a source of citrus in there, I didn't see why there ain't no reason why you couldn't make a battery out of it, and there it is, man. Yeah, I'm anxious to do a video about this. So we got to make it through the next 15 minutes of the show and then uploading the podcast, and then I got to get on to making a video.
don't just make a video of one. Make a video of one, and then a series of two, and then four, and eight, and I mean, make it really, really interesting.
I'm gonna see how far I can push it. See if I can light a light bulb with it.
There you go. Now you're cooking. You're cooking with gas, bubble.
Well, right now, if it wasn't for the LED being on there, which isn't lit, because I don't know if I got the poles right on the LED.
Uh-huh.
Or if there's enough voltage, I don't remember what the volt range on these particular LEDs were, but that LED is actually draining off right now, because it's connected, unless it's reversed. The only way to find that is to do some more testing and switch that LED around and see.
Okay.
But either way, there's a load on it right now, and it's at 0.69. The LED has to be some sort of load on it, right?
Not if you got it backwards. It wouldn't be a load at all.
Just be a diode on there.
Yeah. No, that LED is a diode.
It's up to 0.70 now. I'll just grab another LED and...
Reverse the LED. Reverse it. See if it comes on. You might have it in backwards.
All right, somebody do some talking. We're live.
Oh, Lord.
Do, 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 do.
Thomas. Thomas, you there? Uh-oh. Everybody's gone and left me all by my lonesome.
I'm still here.
You know, Thomas and I were talking yesterday about making alcohol from cellulose. And I brought up a thing I've been thinking about for a few years. And, you know, I wasn't raised on the farm or anything, but I have had a lot of farm living experience in my younger days. And cattle... sheep, goats, rabbits, everything that chews a cud eats grass, and they turn that grass, that cellulose, into sugar, and they digest that, and that's where they get their energy. And man's keep trying to figure out an inexpensive way to turn cellulose into sugar so that he can make alcohol for fuel. But can't figure out exactly how or what the enzymes in the stomach acids of the grass-eating animals, how it does it. And the one thing that I've noticed that no one's ever made mention
almost all grass-eating animals stick their tongue up their nose. Is it possible that the enzyme that they actually need to turn cellulose into sugar is in the mucus in the noses? Think about that.
I don't know, but that sounds disgusting.
It may sound disgusting, but it's a possibility.
Yeah. When I reverse
it. You ever had a handful of crude oil?
Yeah.
Stuck your hand in motor oil?
Yes, I have.
Both pretty disgusting, too, so, I mean... But you still use it to get around.
Yep.
I put a second LED...
Figure out what enzyme is in that mucus, in that cow's nose, and combine it with the enzymes in the stomach. And you're probably going to find out a very, very inexpensive way, very simple way, to turn cellulose into sugar. I mean, sometimes the simplest things are overlooked because they are so simple. Everybody wants to look for the hard way, you know, the complicated way. Sometimes things are just so simple, you can't see it. Like, you can't see the forest with the trees.
Well, I don't know what's going on with this doggone hedge ball, but I took the capacitor off it, and it's at 0.71 volts.
0.71?
Yeah.
That's almost 0.75 volts, man.
Yeah, that's without the capacitor or the LED on it.
That beats a lemon. That beats a lemon or an orange. Come on, man.
Pretty impressive. I'm hooking the capacitor and the LED back up. Live.
What volt is needed for your LED to light up? How many volts does it take?
I'm pretty sure these are 3-volt LEDs.
Well, you're not going to get it light up very well then.
No.
You're going to have to hook a couple of those horse apples up in series to get you up to 3 volts.
All right. Right now, it's under a load, and it has the LED should be lighting up if there was enough voltage. It's maintaining at 0.48 volts under load, and it's going up to 0.49. What do you think? Cricket chirp. Chirp, chirp, chirp.
Alright, your constant was 6 volts. So, and you need 0.6, I'm sorry. Your constant was 0.6, and you need 3 volts to light up your LED. So 3 divided by 0.6. is 5, exactly. You need 5 of those horse apples hooked up in series to get 3 volts and light that LED.
Cool.
And that should light it continuously, not blink.
Yeah, and it'd be interesting to see how long it actually stays going, too, how long that chemical reaction will go.
Depending on the size of your galvanized, your zinc in the galvanized is what's actually creating the electric charge, because it's actually dissipating and it will wear out. So if you use a galvanized piece of metal, the bigger it is, the longer it will last. The more surface area you have, the longer it will last. Now, as it deteriorates, there'll be a grayish substance buildup. So every 24 hours, you'll have to take the galvanized, just slide it out, wipe it with a dry paper towel, and stick it back in. Otherwise, the corrosion will get so thick that the actual voltage production will slow down. Your amperage production, I'm sorry, not your voltage, but your amperage will diminish. You have to keep that crud off of it.
Cool. So this is going to be a long-term experiment then.
I had a copper and galvanized piece of metal in salt water, and it ran 24 hours a day for 11 straight days. I had a blinking multicolor LED on it, and it ran 24 hours a day for 11 straight days.
Cool. Sounds like you're at the airport, Raymond.
Oh, my air conditioner's not running.
Oh, maybe it's the microphone feeding back or something. All right, so now I'm hooking a completely different capacitor to it and by itself so that I can check the voltage again. This is terrible for radio, man. But it's all in the name of science, folks.
Man, that's why you need video.
Yeah.
You don't have to say nothing because they can see what you're doing. So if you aren't talking, they still got something to watch.
Yeah.
Especially when you shock yourself or slip and fall.
And that makes like slapstick comedy.
Yeah, you might get sued by Electro Boom, though.
All right. All I got on there right now is just a capacitor, and it's at 0.70 and rising. Pretty cool, man. Pretty cool.
All right. That 0.70, that sounds impressive, but the fact that you shorted it out and held it, and it held a 0.6 continuous, that is super impressive to me, because that means that anything that you put in series, you get it right, and it will continuously run something for 10 to 11 days, depending on your surface area.
Cool.
24 hours a day. 11 straight days.
Well, see, we would have never figured this out had Thomas not have said that it was a source of citric acid.
Right.
Now,
think about that. Now everybody's going to go out and be kind of planting burdock trees all over the land.
What's that word again?
Burdock.
Bodark?
Bodark.
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 Well, around here we call them hedge trees.
Yeah, I've
heard them called hedge apples, hedge balls, horse apples.
Horse apples, yeah.
And I know the deer like to munch on them, and bugs like to eat them. Certain bugs, not...
Horse apples.
Could be worse. Could be worse. But right now, it's maintaining and charging the capacitor. It's at going up to 0.72 now.
Wow.
I wonder what would happen if I actually hook a small charge to it. Let's figure that out, man. I'm gonna get a 9-volt battery that I know is charged up. If you guys hear a loud boom, then you know I got hedge apple on my face.
Put your safety glasses on, just in case. Always safe.
Yeah, practice safety first.
Safety first. Heck yeah, always.
Alright, I am getting some leads. The thing is up to 0.72.
Never safe, quote. Always sorry.
I got a lead on the positive. This is a nickel hydride battery. Nickel metal hydride, and I'm going to connect them to the deal. And I'm going to touch the positive on there. So the next sound you hear could be a exploding hedge apple.
You're talking about a natural grown hand grenade.
It went all the way up to 9.13 volts.
Whoa.
Okay, I released it down. Now the voltage is dropping back down. It's down to 1.30 volts right now. And slowly falling. Let's see where it ends up, where it actually stops.
It's dropping a lot slower, isn't it?
Yeah.
Wow.
It's at 1.7 and slowing down. It's 1.15 right now. It's over a volt right now.
So actually what you're saying is that it is a battery. You can charge it.
Yeah, I want to see where it finally levels out.
You can actually charge the thing up.
It looks like it stopped at 1.11 so far. It's actually really seriously slowing down.
It's down to 1.10. All right, well, we're down to like the last 6 minutes of the show, so I'm going to have to do a video on this.
Did you reverse that?
You should have done a video anyway.
Yeah. Hey, when you hook the battery up, did the LED light up?
Oh, no, I already took the LED off of it.
Because if it didn't light up, then you definitely had the LED in reverse.
Yeah. So, I will run some experiments and do a video of it and see how far I can push a hedge apple.
You're going to run some experiments?
Yeah.
There you go.
Well, it didn't blow up, so I guess you guys missed out on the laughter of the hedge ball, the grenade blowing up in Noshaziz's crazy hair. Big old chunks of green hedge ball.
You know, those things get kind of sticky. They put off a real sticky sap. I wonder if you could use that for like a hair straightener or whatever.
Probably. That's what I was saying. It's either going to be glue or you're going to be able to make some sort of biofuel out of it.
Right.
Or right now, you know, you can make a battery. It's at 1.06. And we know that it was down there.
Man, it doesn't matter how many great things you make out of it. There are some people out there who are still like, yeah, but hemp. But hemp. Yeah, but they won't let us have hemp.
Well, they'll probably outlaw hedge then when it's all over.
How often is horse apple?
And
smoke them.
Yeah, grind them up and smoke them, man. We don't advocate you smoke hedge apples. Man, we're going to get ourselves in trouble one way
or another. Man, we don't advocate you advocate.
Yeah, we don't advocate advocating anything, and we suggest you get rid of the suggestion box. Oh, man.
Man, that'll be enough out of you.
Yeah, that's it.
I bet this podcast goes viral bad. It's got to. Oh, yeah. People will be listening, laughing.
All right, well, it's at 1.04, and it's seriously really slowing down. I mean, it's almost at a dead stop now. It takes a while before it's dropping down any. So we had it at 0.71 with a capacitor on it. And
you didn't hook it up for very long either.
We were able to charge it up to it actually put the full nine volts to it, and it did fall, but it finally started slowing down and leveled out, and now it's at getting ready to drop down to 1.03 after all the talking that I did.
So it will store electricity.
Yeah. And so I'm saying that's pretty doggone impressive, man. From a hedge ball.
I'm really curious as to what's going to happen when you get more surface area on your copper and your galvanized.
Yeah, me too, because that one copper...
Or how about you change what materials you're using for something more reactive?
Yeah.
Okay, don't use galvanized. Use a pure piece of zinc.
I don't know if I have a pure piece of zinc. I got some magnesium blocks.
Get some old silver coins.
Yeah, that's possible.
Wrap the edge up and block off that copper that's on the inside.
This thing is actually stopped at 1.03 so far.
Or take some old silver coins and some old solid copper pennies and take some tissue paper and soak it in that hedge apple juice and put it on in between there.
It's getting ready to drop down to 1.02, but the key about this whole thing is that doggone, because it's got a capacitor attached to it, it's above what it was, and it's really slowly draining out. So if I had the same setup running series, I'm positive this thing will have enough power to light something. So anyway, we're down to the wire, actually running over here. So basically, you've been listening to Mad Science Show. If you like what we're doing, I'll put a video out, Stephen, and show you. I'm making a hedge ball battery, a redneck battery. And it's actually at 1.02 volts right now after I hit it with a 9-volt battery, and it dropped it back down to slowly drop back down to where it's at now.
without the battery ever being introduced, it was at 0.71 and rising. So somewhere between there, it'll find its maximum pressure that it can push into that capacitor. And I'm going to actually try a larger capacitor to see if I can get a better result. Anyway, you've been listening to Mad Science. Thank you, Thomas. Thank you, Raymond, once again. And I'll get a video out this afternoon on this, because I'm really excited about it. I've been trying to find some use for hedge apples. I got these all over my property in different areas, so I got a pretty much unlimited supply of hedge apples. Maybe I can go in the hedge apple business. What do you guys think?
I got a cool idea, man.
All right, redneck batteries for sale. $19.95 plus tax. That's $50 for those of you who can't count. All right, take care. You've been listening to Mad Science. Share the podcast if you like what we're talking about. Peace and love, everybody. Take care.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission: to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Crap.
Operator, give me the number for 911.